Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Coming up next, Book TV presents Afterwards, an hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, Jay Perini, biographer, novelist, and poet, talks about his book, Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. In the book, Mr. Perini identifies the 13 publications he believes have most influenced American culture and analyzes the nature of their impact. He discusses his book with Sam Tannenhaus, editor of the New York Times Book Review.
But certainly going back to the souls of black folk and the whole great tradition of African American literature and seeing what the issues are, how they play out, and we can become post-racial only by first understanding race in all of its complexity and all of its horror.
Now you discuss a third classic that deals with race. Mark Twain's Great Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Well, you know, Hemingway once said, all American fiction comes from Huckleberry Finn.
What did he mean by
and
that?
I think he meant that this is the essential American story. It's the story of the boy from nowhere, again going back to Ben Franklin, Huck Finn, whose father, he's an orphan boy essentially. His father's a drunk who doesn't look after him.
He beats
him up. So this is a boy in the wild Midwest, almost West Missouri. And he's raised in Hannibal on the banks of the Mississippi. And he breaks away from society. He's kind of almost a black boy himself. One of the arguments somebody makes, and I talk about it here, is that Huck himself is almost a black kid. He uses a lot of black dialect. He's an outsider.
And his closest friend in the novel is
Jim.
A black man.
Well, he's called throughout the novel Nigger Jim. And Huck Finn and Jim, this escaping slave, go on a raft and they sail down the Mississippi, on the Mississippi, out to freedom. I mean, one of the motions of Huckleberry Finn that I love is lighting out for the territory. I mean, at the very end of the book, Huck says, I'm going to light out for the territory. And essentially, he votes in favor of liberating Jim. He's going to break the law and support this black guy.
In fact, he thinks it's an immoral act to do it. In one of the great passages.
He says, "Oh my God, do I dare break the law here and not turn in this black slave to his rightful owner?" And he says, "I don't care. I will break the law." So civil disobedience, interestingly enough, comes into play here.
How popular was The Adventures of Huck Finn when it was published? Twain was already America's most popular, beloved author. Author of Tom Sawyer. This is a somewhat different book. Huck Finn does appear in Tom Sawyer. He conceived it, I think we know, as a truly serious literary work. Was it received that way?
We remember it was banned from libraries very early on. Some reviewers and some librarians thought because of the rough language in the book, and Huck is cussing all the time, that it was not a decent book. So for various reasons, in the 19th century because of the indecency of the language, and in the 20th century because of its treatment of race, this is one of the most banned books by American librarians.
Is it still banned in some libraries today?
It may not be right now.
It
has been recently. I think one could go on the internet and find out in a minute. But certainly recently it has been a banned book in the United States. I mean, it's really shocking to think this is a country where a librarian or a school board would ever ban a book. It's pretty shocking.
Why would it be banned today?
I think today because of the phrase Nigger Jim. Many people think maybe it's racist in some way. Obviously, you're a very poor reader of this book if you read this book and think that Mark Twain is in any way a racist. If anything, this is a book about American freedom, and it's about the possibilities of post-racialism. I mean, I really think that this is our primary text. It is our greatest American novel. It's a book I've reread throughout my entire life, and as with all classics, a classic is a book that you can read at different stages in your life, and it every turn, it will speak to you in new ways and inform your life and really enlighten your life in remarkably new and fresh ways.
Let's talk about a very different kind of classic that I was a little surprised to see in your list, but it's fun anyway, and that's Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah.
When was that book written, and who was Dale Carnegie?
Well, yeah, there's I think there are just two books of my 13 that many reviewers think are a little cuckoo. One is How to Win Friends and Influence People. The other one would be Dr. Spock's Book of Baby and Child Care. But let's focus on Dale Carnegie. When I was a 12 or 13-year-old kid, I was extremely shy in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I really had very few friends. I was frightened and didn't know how to talk to people. I was very inward. And I was in a department store, the Scranton Globe, and I saw this paperback, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and I thought, that's for me. So I took it home, and I read through Dale Carnegie's Ways of Making Friends. And he said, I'll just go with the first one. He said, find something to praise in everybody, because everybody's got something good about them. And if you find that and you focus on that, that person will be very happy, and you'll be able to start a conversation.
And you describe in the book how sometimes it was hard to do.
I got my notebook, and I remember sitting there in my seventh grade class and taking out my pen while the teacher was talking, and I'd go, Joe, football player, wow, he can really throw a ball. Sam, good, he acts and plays. He's amazing. And then there was this girl called, Kathy, let's call her. She was the most unlikely figure imaginable. And I went days trying to think what I could find out about her. And then I realized in Spanish class, a little introduction to Spanish I was taking, she said words with a rolling R. And I love, she'd say, burro. And she really emphasized this. And so I went up to her after class one day, and I said, Kathy, you speak Spanish with such a lovely accent. You could almost be, Spanish. Well, as I say, she would have married me that day. She was my friend till the day we graduated. And,
So this is really one of the great how-to and advice classics. Books like this come out all the time. What sets this one apart? It's still with us. It's still read. It's still talked about. Why?
Well, there's a tone there that, this is in the midst of the Depression, 1936, when millions and millions and millions of people were out of work. Remember, the jobless rate was, over 20%. And so people were trying to think, how am I going to manage my life in this terrible world, this economic world? And here was a way out. Carnegie said, look, you can take matters into your own hand. In many ways, he's the 20th century version of Ben Franklin. He says you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps. There's a dark side to it. He says there's a subtle theme of ingratiate yourself with your boss. See what the boss wants before the boss himself sees what he wants.
Now, how did he know all this? What was his background, Carnegie's?
His background was he was a boy from the middle of nowhere, from the Midwest, who became a salesman. And he found out just by learning how to go door-to-door selling various products, how to sell. He moved to New York City and took acting lessons and learned how to present himself. But he pretty much formulated the ideas in how to win friends and influence people, I think just by thinking it through and by practicing sales. And there was a lot of interest in sales in America, going back to Sears Roebuck catalog, of course, was a great sales pitch. But there were conventions of salespeople, lots of talk about how to make the sale. Well, I think Dale Carnegie just pulled conventional wisdom on how to become a salesman together with certain kinds of basic good spiritual advice. I mean, essentially, I see this book as a religious book, believe it or not.
How's it religious?
I mean, I think that the core of every religion is lose yourself to find yourself. That really, the self does who we are, Jay Perini, doesn't matter. I mean, who cares? What matters is how we get along with other people, how we can help other people, how we can build community. And I think Carnegie understood this. And it's all about losing the self, this book. And he quotes Christ, he quotes the Buddha, he quotes various Oriental scriptures. It's oddly wise, this book.
Was he well read?
Well, you know, I think he must have been very well read. He certainly found great quotations. So how I don't think he was an intellectual, but there's a very powerful writing style in this book, which I still found riveting. You know, I was a little scared going back to it. I hadn't read it since I was 13. And I went back and I read it, and I must say, I found myself prickling all over, and I found sweat on my forehead as I read it. First of all, it brought me back to junior high school, which is never a happy time for anyone. But I also realized here's a book that contains a great deal of wisdom, and here is the American character. I mean, one of the things I was trying to do in this book was take an X-ray of the American psyche, find out who we are by asking where we have been intellectually and emotionally. And what better place to find out where we've been intellectually and emotionally than in the books that have shaped our consciousness, that have created our sense of who we are, our character, the strange thing, the American character.
Context of white supremacy. Justice, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 21st, 2013, so I have been told, also the first day of summer, so I have been told, in the Pacific Northwest, it is not that warm. It feels like maybe a late April. It's in the 60s. My apologies for the folks who, that's 60 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't have the immediate Celsius conversion. I'm a victim. But it is not that warm here yet. Hopefully, wherever you happen to be on the global plantation, warmer weather, safe as possible, improving your quality of life and actively demonstrating, utilizing your knowledge about the system of racism. White supremacy. We will be back on Saturday, tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to catching up on what has been going down the past 7 days. If you have been having difficulties on the plantation, please dial in. Let us know. If you have been having triumphs, if you've figured out some codification, you've been having success in dealing with white people on your job, they haven't been making trouble for you, you've been getting your promotions, making things happen, staying out of trouble. You want to hear that too. Dial in, want to share. And to encourage more folks to dial in and participate, we should have easy access for folks if you want to listen and or participate. Really easy. I'm going to give the directions. I'm going to be doing it next week or so. I'll keep going over it so that if anybody is confused, if you're having any problems, it should be easy to correct. But all you need to do, anywhere in the world, I know we have folks that listen outside the states, if you want to listen live or if you want to call in, listen or to participate, go to this address, tiny.cc/oneRace, and that's the number one, tiny.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one, tiny.cc/oneRace. So you go to that, you will be on the free conference call HD conferencing page. From there, you will see on the left side of the page, it says dial in via our flash phone. It's a blue button. It says click here to launch. Click that button. If you have a iPhone, smartphone, mobile app, you can download an app that will work as well. I know we have people who listen to the program on their phones, even around the world. This will work for free, and this should work much better than Skype. So if there are people who are anywhere in the world, if you use Skype to call in or you've tried to use Skype to call in, I know sometimes there are difficulties. I have that problem too. This should work. Permanent solution, and it is free, and it should work anywhere on the planet. I'm going to walk through how you dial in with a flash phone, but if you have a smartphone, iPhone, whatever, there's an app you can download. That's the same thing that I'm explaining, so that you'll just have it as an app on your phone. and you can use that to dial in as well. All of that is on the same page, tiny.cc/one race. So just walking through it for the folks who want to dial in with the flash phone setup, which is free, easy. You don't have to download anything. All you do is click the click here to launch button. When you click it, a little window will open. It says flash phone, where it says list of numbers. You click it, there's a drop down menu. Pick the number that we've been saying for years now, 760-569-7676. Then where it says access code, you want to put in 564-943. Again, after you've chosen our number, which is 760-569-7676, where the access code is, just put in 564-943. You can put your name in if you like. You can use, you know, a pseudonym or whatever. Or if you already have a handle that you use, you can put that in where it says name. Or you can leave it blank. You don't have to put anything in. Once you've entered those two lines, click the green bar that says place call, and you will be connected. Very easy. It will look the same way that a normal phone pad looks anywhere in the world. And if you want to talk, you can listen. Like I said, you can use this to listen. And if you would like to speak, it's the same procedure. You press *6 on the dial pad. You should hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. If you want to put your hand up, press 1. I'll see your hand, and there you go. Very easy. It's free. You don't have to download anything unless, you know, you're downloading the app for your smartphone or whatever. But if you're just going to listen online with your computer or what have you, this should work. It should be efficient. It should be painless, simple, and it should work without any problems. If you get confused, if it doesn't work, just drop me an email and let me know. But it should permanently solve the problem for anyone in the world who listens to the Cows, who wants to dial in, participate. We should have a free, easy way for you to do so now. And I'm encouraging folks who are outside the states to dial in and participate, because I think that would also really help us get a better understanding of what's happening to us. Moving forward. This week, second study session on Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. We left off last week. He was speaking about the importance of praising other folks and not criticizing. He talked about, he stressed the importance of that and how criticism can wound for years. And the exact opposite, praising and not being phony and fake and unctuous, trying to flatter someone, even spelling out the differences between the two. But I mean, being sincere with your praise of other folks and really trying to pay attention to that person, listen to that person, so that you can sincerely compliment them on things that are important to them, that they, in fact, do have some skill and expertise in. I think he emphasizes that everybody does have skill in one area or another. Make sure you note that. Sometimes we need to be reminded of that, especially victims of racism. At any rate, the audio at the beginning of the program, wow, fascinating. That was racist suspect Jay Perini. Now, he's written many books, but the book he was talking about in that segment is called Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Now, he mentions How to Win Friends and Influence People as one of his 13 books, but a lot of the other books, Mark Twain, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, W.E.B. Du Bois, Souls of Black Folks, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin. He has a lot of books that are dealing with racism. This is, as he said, like an hour program, and they spent about 55 minutes talking about racism. I think the first book that he mentioned was Diary Entries from a Plantation. And they had a lot of stuff dealing with the colonial period and white people and their interactions with so-called Native Americans, non-white people. slavery, as I said. I mean, the whole thing was just racism, 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 racism. I think the first book that he got to that did not deal directly with racism was How to Win Friends and Influence People. But I just thought that that was fascinating. That was the whole reason that I listened to that program to begin with, was to hear what he was going to say about Mr. Carnegie's book. And then to hear him talking about racism the whole time, fascinating. You can check it out. It's on Book TV, Jay Perini. At any rate, I thought some of what he had to say about Mr. Carnegie also was pretty interesting, about the time period, the insight, the quotes, and that information. Just, again, goes to show, I think this is a pretty successful code for managing people and being effective with the way that you use your words. We will get started with segment number two, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Context of White Supremacy.
At one time, I rented the grand ballroom of a certain New York hotel for 20 nights each season in order to hold a series of lectures. At the beginning of one season, I was suddenly informed that I should have to pay almost three times as much rent as formerly. This news reached me after the tickets had been printed and distributed and all announcements had been made. Naturally, I didn't want to pay the increase, but what was the use of talking to the hotel about what I wanted? They were interested only in what they wanted. So a couple of days later, I went to see the manager. "I was a bit shocked when I got your letter," I said, "but I don't blame you at all. If I'd been in your position, I should probably have written a similar letter myself. Your duty as manager of the hotel is to make all the profit possible. If you don't do that, you'll be fired, and you ought to be fired. Now let's take a piece of paper and write down the advantages and the disadvantages that will accrue to you if you insist on this increase in rent." And then I took the letterhead and ran a line through the center and headed one column advantages and the other column disadvantages. I wrote down under the head advantages these words, "Ballroom free." And then I went on to say, "You'll have the advantage of having the ballroom free to rent for dances and conventions. And that's a big advantage, for affairs like that will pay you much more than you can get for a series of lectures. If I tie your ballroom up for 20 nights during the course of the season, it's sure to mean a loss of some very profitable business to you. Now, let's consider the disadvantages. First, instead of increasing your income from me, you're going to decrease it. In fact, you're going to wipe it out because I cannot pay the rent you're asking. I shall be forced to hold these lectures at some other place. There's another disadvantage to you also. These lectures attract crowds of educated and cultured people to your hotel. That is good advertising for you, isn't it? In fact, if you spent $5,000 advertising in the newspapers, you couldn't bring as many people to look at your hotel as I can bring by these lectures. That is worth a lot to the hotel, isn't it?" As I talked, I wrote these two disadvantages under the proper heading and handed the sheet of paper to the manager, saying, "I wish you'd carefully consider both the advantages and disadvantages that are going to accrue to you, and then give me your final decision." I received a letter the next day informing me that my rent would be increased only 50% instead of 300%. Mind you, I got this reduction without saying a word about what I wanted. I talked all the time about what the other person wanted and how he could get it. Suppose I had done the human, natural thing. Suppose I had stormed into his office and said, "What do you mean, raising my rent 300%, when you know the tickets have been printed and the announcements made? 300%? Ridiculous! Absurd! I won't pay it!" What would have happened then? An argument would have begun to steam and boil and sputter, and you know how arguments end. Even if I had convinced him that he was wrong, his pride would have made it difficult for him to back down and give in. Here is one of the best bits of advice ever given about the fine art of human relationships. "If there is any one secret of success," said Henry Ford, "it lies in the ability to get the other person's point of view and see things from that person's angle as well as from your own." That is so good, I want to repeat it. If there is any one secret of success, it lies in the ability to get the other person's point of view and see things from that person's angle as well as from your own. That is so simple, so obvious, that anyone ought to see the truth of it at a glance. Yet 90% of the people on this earth ignore it 90% of the time. An example? A look at the letters that come across your desk tomorrow morning, and you find that most of them violate this important canon of common sense. Take this one, a letter written by the head of the radio department of an advertising agency with offices scattered across the continent. This letter was sent to the managers of local radio stations throughout the country. To Mr. John Blank, Blankville, Indiana. Dear Mr. Blank, the XYZ Company desires to retain its position in advertising agency leadership in the radio field. Who cares what your company desires? I'm worried about my own problems. The bank is foreclosing the mortgage on my house. The bugs are destroying the hollyhocks. The stock market tumbled yesterday. I missed the 8:15 this morning. I wasn't invited to the Joneses' dance last night. The doctor tells me I have high blood pressure and neuritis and dandruff. And then what happens? I come down to the office this morning worried, open my mail, and hear some little whippersnapper off in New York yapping about what his company wants. Bah! If he only realized what sort of impression his letter makes, he would get out of the advertising business and start manufacturing sheep dip. This agency's national advertising accounts were the bulwark of the network. Our subsequent clearances of station time have kept us at the top of agencies year after year. You are big and rich and right at the top, are you? So what? I don't give two hoops in Hades if you're as big as General Motors and General Electric and the general staff of the U.S. Army all combined. If you had as much sense as a half-witted hummingbird, you'd realize that I'm interested in how big I am, not how big you are. All this talk about your enormous success makes me feel small and unimportant. We desire to service our accounts with the last word on radio station information. You desire. You desire. You unmitigated ass. I'm not interested in what you desire or what the President of the United States desires. Let me tell you once and for all that I am interested in what I desire, and you haven't said a word about that yet in this absurd letter of yours. Will you therefore put the XYZ Company on your preferred list for weekly station information, every single detail that will be useful to an agency in intelligently booking time? Preferred list? You have your nerve. You make me feel insignificant by your big talk about your company, and then you ask me to put you on a preferred list, and you don't even say please when you ask it. A prompt acknowledgement of this letter, giving us your latest doings, will be mutually helpful. You fool. You mail me a cheap form letter, a letter scattered far and wide like the autumn leaves, and you have the gall to ask me, when I'm worried about the mortgage and the hollyhocks and my blood pressure, to sit down and dictate a personal note acknowledging your form letter, and you ask me to do it promptly. What do you mean, promptly? Don't you know I'm just as busy as you are, or at least I like to think I am? And while we're on the subject, who gave you the lordly right to order me around? You say it will be mutually helpful. At last, you have begun to see my viewpoint, but you're vague about how it will be to my advantage. Very truly yours, John Doe, Manager, Radio Department. P.S. The enclosed reprint from the Blankville Journal will be of interest to you, and you may want to broadcast it over your station. Finally, down here in the postscript, you mentioned something that may help me solve one of my problems. Why didn't you begin your letter with... Oh, what's the use? Any advertising man who's guilty of perpetrating such drivel as you've sent me has something wrong with his medulla oblongata. You don't need a letter giving our latest doings. What you need is a quart of iodine in your thyroid gland. Now, if people who devote their lives to advertising and who pose as experts in the art of influencing people to buy, if they write a letter like that, what can we expect from the butcher and the baker or the auto mechanic? Here's another letter written by the superintendent of a large freight terminal to a student of this course, Edward Vermillon. What effect did this letter have on the man to whom it was addressed? Let me read it to you, and then I'll tell you. A. Zarega's Sons, Incorporated, 28 Front Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11201. Attention, Mr. Edward Vermillion. Gentlemen. The operations at our outbound rail receiving station are handicapped because a material percentage of the total business is delivered us in the late afternoon. This condition results in congestion, overtime on the part of our forces, delays to trucks, and in some cases, delays to freight. On November 10th, we received from your company a lot of 510 pieces, which reached here at 4:20 p.m. We solicit your cooperation toward overcoming the undesirable effects arising from late receipt of freight. May we ask that on days on which you ship the volume which was received on the above date, effort be made either to get the truck here earlier or to deliver us part of the freight during the morning. The advantage that would accrue to you under such an arrangement would be that of more expeditious discharge of your trucks and the assurance that your business would go forward on the date of its receipt. Very truly yours, John Brown, Superintendent. After reading this letter, Mr. Vermillion, sales manager for A. Zarega's Sons, Incorporated, sent it to me with the following comment. This letter had the reverse effect from that which was intended. The letter begins by describing the terminal's difficulties, in which we're not interested, generally speaking. Our cooperation is then requested without any thought as to whether it would inconvenience us. And then, finally, in the last paragraph, the fact is mentioned that if we do cooperate, it will mean more expeditious discharge of our trucks with the assurance that our freight will go forward on the date of its receipt. In other words, that in which we are most interested is mentioned last, and the whole effect is one of raising a spirit of antagonism rather than of cooperation. Let's see if we can't rewrite and improve this letter. Let's not waste any time talking about our problems. As Henry Ford admonishes, let's get the other person's point of view and see things from his or her angle, as well as from our own. Here's one way of revising the letter. It may not be the best way, but isn't it an improvement? Mr. Edward Vermillion, care of A. Zarega's Sons, Incorporated, 28 Front Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11201. Dear Mr. Vermillion, your company has been one of our good customers for 14 years. Naturally, we're very grateful for your patronage and are eager to give you the speedy, efficient service you deserve. However, we regret to say that it isn't possible for us to do that when your trucks bring us a large shipment late in the afternoon, as they did on November 10th. Why? Because many other customers make late afternoon deliveries also. Naturally, that causes congestion. That means your trucks are held up unavoidably at the pier, and sometimes even your freight is delayed. That's bad, but it can be avoided. If you make your deliveries at the pier in the morning, when possible, your trucks will be able to keep moving. Your freight will get immediate attention, and our workers will get home early at night to enjoy a dinner of the delicious macaroni and noodles that you manufacture. Regardless of when your shipments arrive, we shall always cheerfully do all in our power to serve you promptly. You are busy. Please don't trouble to answer this note. Yours truly, John Brown, Superintendent. Barbara Anderson, who worked in a bank in New York, desired to move to Phoenix, Arizona, because of the health of her son. Using the principles she had learned in our course, she wrote the following letter to 12 banks in Phoenix. Dear Sir, my 10 years of bank experience should be of interest to a rapidly growing bank like yours. In various capacities in bank operations with the Bankers Trust Company in New York, leading to my present assignment as branch manager, I have acquired skills in all phases of banking, including depositor relations, credits, loans, and administration. I will be relocating to Phoenix in May, and I am sure I can contribute to your growth and profit. I will be in Phoenix the week of April 3rd, and would appreciate the opportunity to show you how I can help your bank meet its goals. Sincerely, Barbara A. Anderson. Do you think Mrs. Anderson received any response from that letter? 11 of the 12 banks invited her to be interviewed, and she had a choice of which banks offer to accept. Why? Mrs. Anderson did not state what she wanted, but wrote in the letter how she could help them, and focused on their wants, not on her own. thousands of salespeople are pounding the pavements today, tired, discouraged, and underpaid. Why? Because they're always thinking only of what they want. They don't realize that neither you or I want to buy anything. If we did, we'd go out and buy it. But both of us are eternally interested in solving our problems. And if salespeople can show us how their services or merchandise will help us solve our problems, they won't need to sell us, we'll buy. And customers like to feel that they're buying, not being sold. Yet many salespeople spend a lifetime in selling without seeing things from the customer's angle. For example, for many years I lived in Forest Hills, a little community of private homes in the center of Greater New York. One day, as I was rushing to the station, I chanced to meet a real estate operator who'd bought and sold property in that area for many years. He knew Forest Hills well, so I hurriedly asked him whether or not my stucco house was built with metal lath or hollow tile. He said he didn't know, told me what I already knew that I could find out by calling the Forest Hills Garden Association. Now, the following morning, I received a letter from him. Did he give me the information I wanted? He could have gotten it in 60 seconds by a telephone call, but he didn't. He told me again that I could get it by telephoning and then asked me to let him handle my insurance. He was not interested in helping me. He was interested only in helping himself. J. Howard Lucas of Birmingham, Alabama, tells how two salespeople from the same company handled the same type of situation. He reported, "Several years ago, I was on the management team of a small company. Headquartered near us was the district office of a large insurance company. Their agents were assigned territories, and our company was assigned to two agents, whom I shall refer to as Carl and John. One morning, Carl dropped by our office and casually mentioned that his company had just introduced a new life insurance policy for executives and thought we might be interested later on, and he'd get back to us when he had more information on it. The same day, John saw us on the sidewalk while returning from a coffee break, and he shouted, 'Hey, Luke, hold up. I have some great news for you fellows.' He hurried over and very excitedly told us about an executive life insurance policy his company had introduced that very day. It was the same policy that Carl had casually mentioned. He wanted us to have one of the first issued. He gave us a few important facts about the coverage and ended saying, 'The policy's so new, I'm going to have someone from the home office come out tomorrow and explain it. Now, in the meantime, let's get the application signed and on the way so he can have more information to work with.' His enthusiasm aroused in us an eager want for this policy, even though we still did not have details. When they were made available to us, they confirmed John's initial understanding of the policy, and he not only sold each of us a policy, but later doubled our coverage. Carl could have had those sales, but he made no effort to arouse in us any desire for the policies. The world is full of people who are grabbing and self-seeking, so the rare individual who unselfishly tries to serve others has an enormous advantage. He has little competition. Owen D. Young, a noted lawyer and one of America's great business leaders, once said, "People who can put themselves in the place of other people, who can understand the workings of their minds, need never worry about what the future has in store for them." If you get just one thing out of this book, an increased tendency to think always in terms of other people's point of view and see things from their angle, if you get just that one thing, it may easily prove to be one of the building blocks of your career. Looking at the other person's point of view and arousing in him an eager want for something is not to be construed as manipulating that person so that he will do something that is only for your benefit and his detriment. Each party should gain from the negotiation. In the letters to Mr. Vermillion, both the sender and the receiver of the correspondence gained by implementing what was suggested. Both the bank and Mrs. Anderson won by her letter in that the bank obtained a valuable employee and Mrs. Anderson a suitable job. And in the example of John's sale of insurance to Mr. Lucas, both gained through this transaction. Another example in which everybody gains through this principle of arousing an eager want comes from Michael E. Whidden of Warwick, Rhode Island, who's a territory salesman for the Shell Oil Company. Mike wanted to become the number one salesperson in his district, but one service station was holding him back. It was run by an older man who could not be motivated to clean up his station. It was in such poor shape that sales were declining significantly. This manager would not listen to any of Mike's pleas to upgrade the station. After many exhortations and heart-to-heart talks, all of which had no impact, Mike decided to invite the manager to visit the newest Shell station in his territory. The manager was so impressed by the facilities at the new station that when Mike visited him the next time, his station was cleaned up and had recorded a sales increase. This enabled Mike to reach the number one spot in his district. All his talking and discussion hadn't helped, but by arousing an eager want in the manager, by showing him the modern station, he had accomplished his goal, and both the manager and Mike benefited. Most people go through college and learn to read Virgil and master the mysteries of calculus without ever discovering how their own minds function. For instance, I once gave a course in effective speaking for the young college graduates who were entering the employ of the Carrier Corporation, the large air conditioner manufacturer. One of the participants wanted to persuade the others to play basketball in their free time, and this is about what he said. "I want you to come out and play basketball. I like to play basketball. The last few times I've been down to the gymnasium, there haven't been enough people to get up a game. Two or three of us got to throwing the ball around the other night, and I got a black eye. I wish all of you would come down tomorrow night. I want to play basketball." Did he talk about anything you want? Now, you don't want to go to a gymnasium that no one else goes to, do you? You don't care about what he wants. You don't want to get a black eye. Could he have shown you how to get the things you want by using the gymnasium? More surely. More pep, keener edge to the appetite, clearer brain, fun, games, basketball. To repeat Professor Overstreet's wise advice, first, arouse in the other person an eager want. He who can do this has the whole world with him. He who cannot walks a lonely way. One of the students in my training course was worried about his little boy. The child was underweight and refused to eat properly. His parents used the usual method. They scolded and nagged. "Mother wants you to eat this and that. Father wants you to grow up to be a big man." Did the boy pay any attention to these pleas? And just about as much as you pay to one fleck of sand on a sandy beach. No one with a trace of horse sense would expect a child 3 years old to react to the viewpoint of a father 30 years old. Yet that was precisely what the father had expected. It was absurd. He finally saw that. So he said to himself, "What does that boy want? How can I tie up what I want to what he wants?" It was easy for the father when he started thinking about it. His boy had a tricycle that he loved to ride up and down the sidewalk in front of the house in Brooklyn. A few doors down the street lived a bully, a bigger boy who would pull the little boy off his tricycle and ride it himself. Naturally, the little boy would run screaming to his mother, and she would have to come out and take the bully off the tricycle and put her little boy on again. This happened almost every day. What did the little boy want? It didn't take a Sherlock Holmes to answer that one. His pride, his anger, his desire for a feeling of importance, all the strongest emotions in his makeup, goaded him to get revenge, to smash the bully in the nose. And when his father explained that the boy would be able to wallop the daylights out of the bigger kid someday, if he would only eat the things his mother wanted him to eat, when his father promised him that, there was no longer any problem of dietetics. That boy would have eaten spinach, sauerkraut, salt mackerel, anything in order to be big enough to whip the bully who had humiliated him so often. After solving that problem, the parents tackled another. The little boy had the unholy habit of wetting his bed. He slept with his grandmother. In the morning, his grandmother would wake up and feel the sheet and say, "Look, Johnny, you did it again last night." He would say, "Well, no, I didn't do it. You did it." Scolding, spanking, shaming him, reiterating that the parents didn't want him to do it, none of these things kept the bed dry. So the parents asked, "How can we make this boy want to stop wetting his bed?" What were his wants? Well, first, he wanted to wear pajamas like Daddy instead of wearing a nightgown like Grandmother. Grandmother was getting fed up with his nocturnal iniquities, so she gladly offered to buy him a pair of pajamas if he'd reform. Secondly, he wanted a bed of his own. Grandma didn't object. His mother took him to a department store in Brooklyn, winked at the sales girl, and said, "Here's a little gentleman who would like to do some shopping." The sales girl made him feel important by saying, "Young man, what can I show you?" He stood a couple of inches taller and said, "I want to buy a bed for myself." When he was shown the one his mother wanted him to buy, she winked at the sales girl, and the boy was persuaded to buy it. The bed was delivered the next day, and that night, when father came home, the little boy ran to the door, shouting, "Daddy, Daddy, come upstairs and see my bed that I bought." The father, looking at the bed, obeyed Charles Schwab's injunction. He was hearty in his approbation and lavish in his praise. "You're not going to wet this bed, are you?" the father said. "Oh, no, no, I'm not going to wet this bed." And the boy kept his promise, for his pride was involved. That was his bed. He and he alone had bought it, and he was wearing pajamas now, like a little man. He wanted to act like a man, and he did. Another father, K.T. Dutchman, a telephone engineer, a student of this course, couldn't get his 3-year-old daughter to eat breakfast food. The usual scolding, pleading, coaxing methods had all ended in futility. So the parents asked themselves, how can we make her want to do it? The little girl loved to imitate her mother to feel big and grown up, so one morning they put her on a chair and let her make the breakfast food. At just the psychological moment, father drifted into the kitchen while she was stirring the cereal, and she said, "Oh, look, Daddy, I'm making the cereal this morning." She ate 2 helpings of the cereal without any coaxing, because she was interested in it. She had achieved a feeling of importance. She had found, in making the cereal, an avenue of self-expression. William Winter once remarked that self-expression is the dominant necessity of human nature. Why can't we adapt this same psychology to business dealings? When we have a brilliant idea, instead of making others think it is ours, why not let them cook and stir the idea themselves? They will then regard it as their own. They will like it, and maybe eat a couple of helpings of it. Remember, first arouse in the other person an eager want. He who can do this has the whole world with him. He who cannot walks a lonely way. Principle 3. Arouse in the other person an eager want. In a nutshell, fundamental techniques in handling people. Principle 1. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain. Principle 2. Give honest, sincere appreciation. Principle 3. Arouse in the other person an eager want. Six Ways to Make People Like You. Chapter 1. Do this and you'll be welcome anywhere. Why read this book to find out how to win friends? Why not study the technique of one of the greatest winner of friends the world has ever known? Who is he? You may meet him tomorrow coming down the street. When you get within 10 feet of him, he will begin to wag his tail. If you stop and pat him, he'll almost jump out of his skin to show you how much he likes you. And you know that behind this show of affection on his part, there are no ulterior motives. He doesn't want to sell you any real estate, and he doesn't want to marry you. Did you ever stop to think that a dog is the only animal that doesn't have to work for a living? A hen has to lay eggs, a cow has to give milk, a canary has to sing, but a dog makes his living by giving you nothing but love. When I was 5 years old, my father bought a little yellow-haired pup for 50 cents. He was the light and joy of my childhood. Every afternoon, about 4:30, he would sit in the front yard with his beautiful eyes staring steadfastly at the path, and as soon as he heard my voice or saw me swinging my dinner pail through the buckbrush, he was off like a shot, racing breathlessly up the hill to greet me with leaps of joy and barks of sheer ecstasy. Tippy was my constant companion for 5 years. Then, one tragic night, I shall never forget it, He was killed within 10 feet of my head, killed by lightning. Tippy's death was the tragedy of my boyhood. You never read a book on psychology, Tippy. You didn't need to. You knew, by some divine instinct, that you can make more friends in 2 months by becoming genuinely interested in other people than you can in 2 years by trying to get other people interested in you. Let me repeat that. You can make more friends in 2 months by becoming interested in other people than you can in 2 years by trying to get other people interested in you. Yet I know, and you know, people who blunder through life trying to wigwag other people into becoming interested in them. Of course, it doesn't work. People are not interested in you. They are not interested in me. They are interested in themselves, morning, noon, and after dinner. The New York Telephone Company made a detailed study of telephone conversations to find out which word is the most frequently used. You've guessed it. It is the personal pronoun I. I. It was used 3,900 times in 500 telephone conversations. I. When you see a group photograph that you're in, whose picture do you look for first? If we merely try to impress people and get people interested in us, we will never have many true, sincere friends. Friends, real friends, are not made that way. Napoleon tried it, and in his last meeting with Josephine, he said, "Josephine, I have been as fortunate as any man ever was on this earth, and yet at this hour, you are the only person in the world on whom I can rely." And historians doubt whether he could rely even on her. Alfred Adler, the famous Viennese psychologist, wrote a book entitled What Life Should Mean to You. In that book, he says, "It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow men who has the greatest difficulties in life and provides the greatest injury to others. It is from among such individuals that all human failures spring." You may read scores of erudite tomes on psychology without coming across a statement more significant for you and me. Adler's statement is so rich with meaning that I'm going to repeat it. It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow men who has the greatest difficulties in life and provides the greatest injury to others. It is from among such individuals that all human failures spring. I once took a course in short story writing at New York University, and during that course, the editor of a leading magazine talked to our class. He said he could pick up any one of the dozens of stories that drifted across his desk every day, and after reading a few paragraphs, he could feel whether or not the author liked people. If the author doesn't like people, he said, people won't like his or her stories. This hard-boiled editor stopped twice in the course of his talk on fiction writing and apologized for preaching a sermon. "I am telling you," he said, "the same things your preacher would tell you. But remember, you have to be interested in people if you want to be a successful writer of stories." If that is true of writing fiction, you can be sure it is true of dealing with people face to face. I spent an evening in the dressing room of Howard Thurston the last time he appeared on Broadway. Thurston was the acknowledged dean of magicians. For 40 years, he had traveled all over the world, time and again, creating illusions, mystifying audiences, and making people gasp with astonishment. More than 60 million people had paid admission to his show, and he had made almost $2 million in profit. I asked Mr. Thurston to tell me the secret of his success. His schooling certainly had nothing to do with it, for he ran away from home as a small boy, became a hobo, rode in boxcars, slept in haystacks, begged his food from door to door, and learned to read by looking out of boxcars at signs along the railway. Did he have a superior knowledge of magic? No, he told me hundreds of books had been written about legerdemain, and scores of people knew as much about it as he did. But he had two things that the others didn't have. First, he had the ability to put his personality across the footlights. He was a master showman. He knew human nature. Everything he did, every gesture, every intonation of his voice, every lifting of an eyebrow, had been carefully rehearsed in advance, and his actions were timed to split seconds. But in addition to that, Thurston had a genuine interest in people. He told me that many magicians would look at the audience and say to themselves, "Well, there's a bunch of suckers out there, a bunch of hicks. I'll fool them all right." But Thurston's method was totally different. He told me that every time he went on stage, he said to himself, "I'm grateful because these people come to see me. They make it possible for me to make my living in a very agreeable way. I'm going to give them the very best I possibly can." He declared he never stepped in front of the footlights without first saying to himself over and over, "I love my audience. I love my audience." Ridiculous? Absurd? You're privileged to think anything you like. I am merely passing it on to you without comment as a recipe used by one of the most famous magicians of all time.
Context of white supremacy. I suspect you will never hear Gusty Renegade declare his love for the cow's audience. But a lot of good suggestions, methinks. The number again, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Line should be open if anyone is using the tiny.cc/oneRace. If you're using the new flash phone setup or what have you to dial in, just same thing, press star 6. You'll be prompted, press 1. You can feel free to participate. Number again, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Before we get to the phone lines, a moment of silence for Tippy. White people and their dogs, man. I know some non-white people also are okay with dogs, have dogs, and that sort of thing. I am not a big dog person, so that always just sticks out to me, white people and their affinity for dogs, even though I do think that's a pretty good metaphor. Yeah, what he explained in the book. At any rate, one other quick tidbit I did think was noteworthy. That little section where they talked about the New York Telephone Company doing a study of the word usage on phone calls. This book was published in 1936. It would seem that white people have been eavesdropping on phone calls for a very long time. Nothing new. We will see what folks have to say. Dale Carnegie, section number 2. The person that dialed in 9325, your line should be open. As I see other hands, I will open the line.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
You actually stole one of my thoughts. I was just thinking about that. If this book was written in 1930 and they was doing a survey on telephone calls, then they have been eavesdropping for quite some time. The author likes Ralph Waldo Emerson quite a bit. He quotes him quite a bit, and Emerson has been noted for saying that the ancestor of action is a thought. And I was going to use that the other night on guest that you have, Miss Byron Katie, but I didn't get a chance to call in. Everybody wanted a piece of Miss Katie. But anyway, back to the book. He also influence requires more intuition than intellect. He gave several illustrations of that. You know, one was the housemaid that was able to coerce the care back into the barn with her little finger when Emerson and his son could not get the calf back into the barn. But they seem to also emphasize that in order to influence somebody, you don't necessarily have to be super educated. They kept bringing up that point. You have to have an honest desire to create some type of excitement in the person to want to do something. So I guess that would take some thought. I like the part about the dog. You know, he was saying that the dog is the only animal that don't have to work. But, you know, I'm from Texas, and down there, they take a different view on things. If a dog cannot be a watchdog, he can't hunt or do something of some type of importance, they don't have any need for him. But I can understand his point. He was making a point that if you show some genuine enthusiasm when you're happy to see someone, even when you're talking to him on the telephone, if you're smiling and you have excitement in your voice, it could create, good positive vibes. So I agree with him on that.
White people are very skilled. It's been my experience because they, in my view, they tend to be a bit more skilled with words, having read material like this and study how you go about managing people, dominating groups of people. They tend to be, oh my gosh, lethal at being able to come in and take an interest in a non-white person and play the well-intentioned, well-meaning, not racist white person, and oh my gosh, and oh, your hair is so beautiful, and compliments, and tell, oh, they can do that up. When they talk about how if you do that, you will have that person, they will love you for, I have seen that where white people can do, because they know for victims of racism, you're just getting criticism all day long, abuse, criticism, mistreatment, all day long, or just flat out ignored. So to get that sincere interest, to be able to do that, to listen, and to throw some compliments in here and there, I've just seen where that coming from a white person is just total devastation.
That's similar to the, is that the Copenhagen syndrome?
Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm, okay. Yeah, I wrote down a few notes. Individuals and organizations, you know, the opposites, when you think of dialogue, the opposite of dialogue is monologue, consideration, conceited, authentic, fake, transparent, manipulative, secure, needy, interested in leading, interested in making, interested in meeting needs, or interested in making money. And to build trust or to build tension. I like the part where they gave the difference in an authentic feeling and a fake feeling, flattery versus genuine appreciation. But one of my questions is, if you are very skilled at manipulating, then a person would have a problem determining whether or not your flattery was genuine appreciation or if you were using a cheaper form of flattery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if I think that was the first study session that we did on this book last week, when I said those criticisms, and he talked about it in the book last week, that when you criticize somebody, it stings a lot more. It has much more of a lasting impact than if you compliment someone. And I said, I agree. And I said, I think the ratio was about 10 to 1. And I think it was 909. He dialed in and he said that he had just seen literature that said the same thing, that said about a 10 to 1 ratio, meaning that you, for every criticism that you get, you need 10 compliments to balance that out. And so I think that that goes to exactly what you just said. I think people know in this environment, especially where there's so much deception, that you do have a lot of people who are very slick with words and, you know, can say what you want to hear and say all kinds of nice things to you, and it's some sort of ulterior motive. I think most people have an understanding of that to some degree or another, and I think that's why compliments tend to be so low, and like 10 to 1 ratio. That's exactly right. So, yeah, that's one of the reasons why I said I don't think it's smart to get too tied up in all that.
Yes. He also mentioned towards the end, a magician. Do you remember his name?
I'm scrolling back down. Let's see. The magician's name is Howard Thurston. Is that it?
Thurston.
Yeah, Howard Thurston.
Okay, I read a little bit about Thurston. During that period of time, he was one of the best. And he was influenced by another magician that went by the name of Herman. But this guy's name, Herman, was different than his nephew. His nephew was Leon Herman. And so Mr. Thurston had shown Mr. Herman a card trick. And although it wasn't the famous magician Herman, it was his nephew, he was able to use that he baffled Herman as his billing in order to get top name spots in which to do his magic tricks. So, you know, I started to think, you know, that whole trade is deception. And so, sleight of hand, and he stressed the point that Thurston enjoyed his audience. So, he would always give appreciation to his audience. But then again, at the same time, he was very deceptive in his workings when he did a false billing in order to drum up interest in his magical acts. But although later on he did become very proficient, and I think he went down as one of the greatest magicians, along with the guy that he was learning from. But the whole thing about deception, I think white people are very skilled in deception. And it's very hard to determine when you are being deceived. So that's why I'm skeptical of a lot of things. As a matter of fact, earlier in one of my college courses, one of my psychology instructors said that you should always be skeptical. Never you lose that skepticism. Always remain skeptical of everyone.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. As I said, this book has sold 15 million copies, and I'm sure even more than that number of people have read the book. And I suspect that most of the people who've read this book have been white people. In books similar to this, they are very skilled in the art of deception. And I would, you know, just skepticism, as you said, is good to have that at all times in dealing with white people. With regards to dealing with victims, non-white people, I think a lot of these strategies can be used. And even if you are skeptical, if it's a non-white person, if you don't really know if they have ulterior motives, certainly don't believe that every non-white person has your best intentions in mind. But even just for the sake of trying to minimize conflict, I think a lot of these suggestions are applicable and would probably work well for improving the quality of relationships between fellow victims. And minimizing conflict, keeping the contacts as constructive as possible. And I think one of the key points, because I feel like I've heard a lot of people talk about being around victims of racism who are a little bit more confused and trying to figure out the best way to operate in those situations. And the quote, and he says it a couple times from Henry Ford. He says, one of the best bits of advice ever given about the fine art of human relationships, if there's any one secret of success, it lies in the ability to get the other person's point of view and see things from that person's angle as well as from your own. I think that, and when he talks about being sincerely interested in another person, I think those two suggestions, those two principles can be very helpful in dealing with confused victims of racism. And I say that because, number one, I think if you can really try to think, okay, let me think, if I was in this person's position, victim of racism, I'm confused about racism, how would I be thinking about this? I think if you can do that, I think that could probably go a long way to calming some of those urges when you get frustrated or when you are losing some of your patience in having contact with a confused victim. If you can be trying to think from their perspective, how do you think you would be, what your thought, your thinking would be, your behavior would be, how you would be looking at certain situations and what have you. Just try to keep that in mind. And I think that relates directly with being sincerely interested. That's one of the things I try to do both on the program, real life. If you're around a confused victim, you all are going to be having some contact. Just being interested in that person. That's something that I try to do. If I'm around a victim of racism, I become interested. How has this person been victimized? What has their experience been on the plantation? I can maybe learn some things. I think those two things can really go a long way to kind of minimizing conflict, giving you a little bit more patience, and setting up a scenario where even if you all don't become the best of friends, it's not going towards conflict. And I think it will be a much more constructive time that you spend with non-white people if you can just try to maintain that interest, you know, asking questions, just learning about their life, their experiences, what they think about things. I've said this repeatedly, I'll mute my line here, but about even television programs that they watch. Why do you like these certain programs? If you watch Game, what is it that you like about this program? The kid, just thinking of questions to be sincerely interested, not asking questions, you know, to make them look bad or to shame them, but just sincere interest. And I'll mute my line. If other folks have thoughts or comments, feel free. Press *6 to participate.
I recently had an encounter in our lounge area. We have a television set. And during our break period, sometimes the TV set is the focus of attention. So this particular time, they were watching the I think it's Maury Povich show, where this white man comes on, and he generally has a lot of non-white people that make a fool out of themselves, whether or not this kid is actually the father is the actual father of the kid, and they do a DNA test, this and that. So I asked one of the non-white people that was watching the show that what was the value of this type of program in his view. He kept avoiding the question. You know, he was telling me that the participants were making a fool of themselves. But, you know, I kept reiterating, well, what is the value of the program? Why do you think this particular program is on? And he could never give me a straight answer. And I asked him the following day, and he finally admitted that it had no value. But he continued to watch it. You know, I wanted to make another comment on the skepticism. You know, it seems that, you know, nowadays people are getting more skeptical because I read somewhere that in 1969, when Neil Armstrong went to the moon, only 94% of Americans actually believed that actually happened. You had a small percentage of people that thought that was all staged. And then when it was, I think, people overseas, even less than that, thought that it actually happened. And recently, in the 9/11 attacks, I think that it's probably somewhere around maybe 15 to 20% of people that believe that may have been staged. And so, to me, that points to an increase in skeptics, where people are just not readily buying everything that they see on television or that's thrown at them. But I still think it's a lot of deception going on. I'll mute my line.
Yeah, I don't really see, with regards to non-white people specifically, I don't know. I don't know about the suspicion and or skepticism that we have of white people. It's not sufficient. It's not sufficient now, and it seems it has not been sufficient maybe for the duration of racism, white supremacy. But yeah, it is not good. We seem to be suspicious about many, many things. But white people, not enough suspicion there at all, which is a trap. And their skill with words, I think, goes a long way. I think that's part of being a master deceiver. Is even when there might be a rumor that you are deceptive, you still are able to go out and successfully dupe and fool others. That is a title that should not be minimized or taken lightly. Master deceiver. Yeah, I guess kind of going back to the interest point, because that kind of goes back to some of the questions you were asking, saying you were talking to one of your coworkers on the television thing. I know Dr. Welsing, I remember I was talking to her about, I think it was one of the listeners, they were talking about Revenge of the Nerds, and I was telling her about that, and I think this person had said that was one of their favorite films when they were more confused, and they had seen that film more than 20 times, I think. This is a while ago, but I'm pretty sure this person had said they had seen that film a lot. And so I was telling Dr. Welsing, and she was like, wow, that is so fast. Dr. Welsing, she says that all the time. being sincerely interested. I think that's a big part of why she's so successful with her job. You can put successful in quotes, but why she, I think she's very effective as a physician, psychiatrist. She has a sincere interest in people. I think it's obvious. She's someone that really enjoys studying people, particularly with her acute understanding of racism, white supremacy. So when it's other victims of racism, I don't think I have ever, and I've heard Dr. Welsing talk for years and years and years and years. And I've heard her talk to, I mean, non-white people that are super confused, having sexual intercourse with white people, don't believe in racism, think white people are cool, think that black people are racist. I mean, I have heard her talk to some victims, myself included. And she does not belittle them. I've never heard her get an attitude, talk down to them, call them names, get frustrated. I mean, you can just hear the sincere, genuine interest that she has in learning more about how this happened, the traumas that produce the victim that she's speaking with. Like, I hear it all the time. And just asking questions, asking more questions. I was telling her about the caller in the Revenge of the Nerds, and she said, "Oh wow, what did he enjoy about the film?" And she said, "You know, that I would want more detail about that. I mean, wow, that's 20 times or more than 20 times. That is fascinating. What is he getting?" I mean, just asking more questions and not in a judgmental manner. Just really trying to learn more about what happened. And I think that can be really, I've heard Mr. Fuller, I think, is really good at that as well. I think I've heard him a lot of times where he's talking to people where he can just ask questions a lot of times, just trying to learn more about the person's situation or if they are disagreeing. I've heard him do it sometimes where people are saying that they don't agree with his viewpoint on racism, white supremacy, and he'll just be asking questions, just, you know, not trying to judge the person or tell them they're stupid because you don't agree with me, you're stupid, I've published books, none of that, just tell me more about how you came to this view. Tell me, you know, a little bit more about, you know, what you think about this or what your situation is, or what your job is, whatever they're talking about specifically. I think that can just be phenomenal. Just the ability to ask questions without judgment and, you know, just sincerely allow the person to answer and accept what they say. And then maybe even have some more questions. I think that, and you give the person the opportunity to talk. I can rest there. If other folks don't really have anything to share, I'll give folks maybe another 10 minutes. If they don't have anything to share, we can get to the second segment. But I do think that is super important. It's something that we've talked about a lot on the program, asking questions, not asking rhetorical questions where you don't really want an answer, not asking questions and then rolling your eyes or being disgusted, like even with your body language. Like if you don't say anything per se, but if you roll your eyes or you slouch back, or maybe you're not really looking, or you're showing some other frustration, or maybe some other non-verbal cues that you know, think that this person is loony or whatever the case may be. Just really trying to minimize all that and just, hey, this person is a victim. We're learning. I'm learning. We're all still learning. We're all victims. And maybe I can ask some questions that we both will get a better understanding about what's been happening to us and what we should be doing. I'll mute mine. We'll do like another 10. No one has anything they want to share. We'll get to the second audio segment.
I think that's a very good point that you brought up, and I also was going to say, I think that as callers and as participants in the Kyle's program, we can start to put these rules or practices into action immediately. You know, for instance, when someone asks a question or makes a point, you know, and a lot of us already do that. Give the other person credit. That's a very good point. That reminded me of something else. You know, I'm glad you said that. Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing. You know, all that's very good in making a person feel important and that what they had to say was significant.
the person that dialed in 7892, your line should be open.
One second, Gus.
While person is collecting themselves, I will say that I know victims of racism, we're all under trauma. I've said it before. If we knew more about each other, I think we would be a lot more hesitant, a lot more patient with each other, and a lot more hesitant to criticize and talk bad if we kind of knew the whole life story of each one of us on the plantation of white supremacy. I know for myself, and I have heard this from other listeners, that at times it can be difficult. And I mean, this is victims. It shouldn't, if it sounds strange, this is victims. That sometimes we've been so traumatized that it can be difficult. We are in such an unpleasant space that it's difficult to even say, thank you for sharing. Or whatever. That's a great point that you made. Or what, even those, you know, something as small as that, like two words. Or three, four words. Thank you for sharing. Four words. You know, even that, you don't want to say just in a bad mood or whatever. So as you can, really make that effort. Really make that effort. That talking to myself first and foremost. But I know I've heard that. And even Melba Petilla Beals from Warriors Don't Cry, she was saying that she was with Minnie Jean Brown Trickney when she was about to leave to go to New York. She had been kicked out of school after the Chile incident. And she said that she wanted to tell her how much she meant to her, and they were really close, and her courage and her, you know, being sticking up for herself and all that. She wanted to tell her how much that meant to her and how sad she was for her to be leaving. But she just couldn't get it out. She said she just, for whatever reason, she couldn't get it out. And I'm sure that, you know, that would have meant a lot for, under those circumstances, they were teenagers, victims of racism, they were being threatened and bombed and having urine thrown on them. That would have been so much, you know, for her to say that and the whole nine, but it didn't even happen. And I think that happens to millions of non-white people just because we've been under so much trauma and stress and terror that it's just a really foul situation. But try to make that effort when you can. The other caller, if you're able, your line should be open.
Yes, you went exactly where I was going with the trauma. When the author talked about Alfred Adler, I thought that was interesting because that's who I'm getting my psychological training under, his theory. And he had actually highlighted this quote from Adler, which was, "It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow man who has the greatest difficulty in life and provides the greatest injury to others. It is from among such individuals that all human failures spring." And I think that touches into us being victims under racism, white supremacy, where we have continuous trauma that we end up, you know, being combative with one another, you know, criticizing one another, getting into squabbles, and not being able to have, you know, relationships that are constructive. And I thought it was very interesting that the author decided to highlight that twice. And I don't think he did that. Well, in the version of the book that I have, that's not written in the book twice. So whoever was reading that actually mentioned that twice. So I thought that was pretty interesting to talk about that trauma. That if one thing that has been done is that we've been conditioned to see ourselves as individuals and everyone else around us as threats. So I'm going to mute my line.
That quote, it reminds me of Elijah Muhammad. I'm paraphrasing, but where he says that you don't need a whole lot of individuals who are not vested in a quote-unquote society. Just having one such person is very dangerous. And he was saying pretty much that is what has been done to victims of racism. We just have tons of people who have just been traumatized, don't care about themselves, haven't been cared about, don't care about anybody else. That just creates a very hostile, combative environment. And I think that's what you see with victims of racism worldwide, unfortunately. And white people are to blame for all of that.
Exactly. I also found it interesting. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I also found it interesting about the dog thing. White people and their dogs, once again.
Welsing moment, too. Romulus and Remus. Welsing moment. Also would say, too, I would just say, if you think of the suggestions that are being given out in this book, and this is a bestseller, over 15 million sold, and still rolling strong. They even upgraded. This is a code. You see what white people do with their code. We talked about that last week, how they have a Stevie Wonder reference in this audio version of the book, and how Stevie Wonder wasn't even born at the time that this book was published. You see how they go and revise the code as they go along, so that way it will still be applicable 40, 50 years down the road. You might have to make some changes, some adjustments to the code so you can maximize efficiency. That's something that I've noticed that white people are very efficient at as well, revising their code. But I just compare and contrast the suggestions that are being given in this book. Don't criticize. He says it over and over again. Don't criticize. Lavish in your praise. Find interest, right? All of the things that are being said about how you want to talk to other people, how you want to say things, even if you're trying to get something done, if you want, you know, to try to influence someone else's the way that they think or behave, even that, how you say it to someone, the words that you use, being very selective. Contrast that with programming aimed at dark people on the planet, where it's name calling, where it'll be infamous for name calling and being rude and crass and insulting and name calling and criticizing. It will be, I mean, it is the exact opposite. I would say perhaps beginning to think about that sort of programming and the long history of it, when Pam talks about even Sanford and Son, where you got a black person, a black male calling a black female saying she's so ugly, if I put your face in some dough, I could bake gorilla cookies. Think of all that as just another refined form of warfare on black people. This is how you groom and condition behavior, because we will broadcast, we'll make sure that 60, 70% of the quote unquote entertainment that is directed at black people, that has a black cast, a quote unquote black storyline, something that we've already studied and we know is going to appeal to them. We're going to make sure that 60%, 70% of this content, at least 70%, 60% of this content just has a lot of combative, arguing behavior that will make sure they will continue, large numbers of black people will continue to behave in a manner that is not conducive to constructive behavior, that will produce a lot of conflict, a lot of arguments, and we will be the ones to come in and squash the conflict. We'll just set up entertainment and music, whole nine, that will produce a ton of conflict, while we white people, even predators, racists that we are, master terrorists, even we will make sure that we take time to calm down from our savagery and castrating, raping the planet, to carefully form our words so that we can at least for a little while be codified and courteous in speaking to one another about how we are going to conduct our terroristic affairs. Just maybe a different way of looking at that programming under racism, white supremacy. Anything else folks want to get in?
You know, what is interesting to me is, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what's interesting is when they made the point about everybody is interested in themselves, like the eye, when he did the survey on the telephone calls, the most used word was I. And then there's a saying, there's no I in team. And so you have to, most people think of themselves before they think of others. I'm just wondering how the programming flipped on non-white black people, whereas we think more of in terms of them than we do of ourselves. For instance, is now when you think of the movie Django and the way that Samuel Jackson's character was acting, he was acting that way because he thought that by putting other blacks down, that's what the master did. So by him imitating the master, then that would give him some type of benefit or perks. So that type of conditioning seems to have carried on because it's like someone said before, a black person can ask someone in the store where something is and they'll point it out to you. But a white person asks the same black salesperson and they'll walk them over to them. You know, I see that all the time where, you know, non-white black people in particular, you know, go over and above to appreciate or to show concern for white people and then disdain for other blacks. And I'm wondering to myself, how did that flip? Whereas you're supposed to care more about yourself and those who look like you than someone who don't look like you.
My view is just that's what domination looks like. That is when you are in a position of dominance, you can set up a system, a ritual, and ensure that it takes place for as long as you are in domination that will reward, promote, encourage, and model that specific behavior. So if you want there to be large numbers and or all of the non-white people that are under your domination, if you want them to behave in a manner where they degrade any and all black people, including themselves, and praise, identify with, sympathize with any and all white people on the planet, you just set up a system that will ensure that behavior. And I think that's exactly what white people have done very successfully. And I think you see that in all areas of people activity, even current examples. President Obama, where, in my view, powerful white people, it's likely when he goes to Morehouse and is saying don't make excuses and try to blame problems on racism, saying things like that, and people, particularly people pointing out that it seems like he said this sort of thing over and over again, when he goes and talks to black people, white people could be ordering that directly and or indirectly. White people, as we have had evidence of ghostwriters, white person could have wrote that out in advance, and or white person could have just said, make sure you go out there and, you know, say something, talk down to those niggers, you know, show us you're still on the team. We need evidence that you are still compliant and know your role as nigger in the White House. Now get out there and do it. I easily think that could have happened. I think white people do that all day long, whether it's on the plantation rewarding an enslaved non-white person, rewarding them with a few extra crumbs. If you tell on anybody that's trying to escape or run away, it's very easy to set up that sort of system where non-white people will do exactly what you said. And in fact, white people directly and or indirectly can encourage that sort of behavior on the job. It could easily be something where if a black customer comes in and you are courteous, you go and greet that person immediately. And how can I be of service? And, oh, you want to get this, you want to get that. And you're running around and doing all that. You might get a negative performance evaluation. You know, so I think whether it's at any time under racism, white supremacy, any century, any day, any decade, as long as white people are dominating us, it's very easy to set up that sort of behavior pattern. In fact, unfortunately, that's what I expect from any and all non-white people. And that way I can be pleasantly surprised if that's not the case, just because that's what I talk about. That's why we have the radio program. That's what I expect. I expect non-white people conforming to the racist, white supremacist program, overvaluing white people, total devaluation of non-white people, even themselves. I mute my line.
I would like to point out something that's coming up in the book. I don't know if it would be appropriate or not, but if I don't point it out, the listeners may miss this, and I think it's very important. It's a part when they're talking about names and how important it is to remember someone's name and to call their name. Well, during that part, there's a part where Roosevelt calls his porter George. And that was something that they did during that time. It's called porters George. That wasn't their name, but every black person was George. It's a movie out called 10,000 Men Named George. And that was a form of mistreatment by not calling the porters by their correct name, is to call them George. And in this book, later on, when they're talking about names, they mention Roosevelt calls his porter George. And I just want the other listeners to listen for that particular part.
Thank you for sharing that. Definitely appreciate that. I think we had talked about The Butler earlier this week. I would say pay attention to that film if that pops up in that film at all. I don't know if it's out yet, but the one with Oprah Winfrey and Mariah Carey. I think Terrence Howard is in it as well. Supposed to have all these famous black actors and actresses. But the part about the names, that is coming up. And that's a big one in this book that goes to the same thing about, you know, showing attention and genuine interest in the person that you're talking to. I would say also contrast that, because I've noted that pattern with white people where they, in my view, it is purposeful. That's all I can conclude, that they are purposely mispronouncing black people, non-white people's names, not calling them by their names, calling them by their first name, not calling them by their last name. Not calling them ma'am. I mean, there are anthologies and racks of books documenting this, and it goes all the way through today. Same thing with Dr. Welsing when she talks about them not addressing President Obama, giving him the title, just Obama. When you see President Clinton, it's former Clinton. Sometimes they don't even say former. It'll just be President Clinton was out today, President Carter, and then Obama. Standard, trifling, racist operating procedure. But I would say definitely keep that in mind. In fact, that Kanye West video that I did, George Bush, when he's complaining about Kanye West and accusing Kanye West falsely of having called him a racist, he says it wasn't just Conway. And then later on he says again, it wasn't Conway, da da da, and he goes on talking about how bad this was. Can't even get his name right. And also not Mr. West. First name basis. Standard operating procedure. We will go ahead and get to segment number two. If you did not get to participate, you can, I guess, just take a note, jot down, make sure you don't forget. If you want to share, jot it down. We will be back. We should have a good 30 minutes, should actually be more than 30 minutes of dialogue time. So we definitely would love to hear from folks. If you have feedback, context of white supremacy, this is audio segment number two, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
George Dyke of North Warren, Pennsylvania, was forced to retire from his service station business after 30 years when a new highway was constructed over the site of his station. It wasn't long before the idle days of retirement began to bore him, so he started filling in his time trying to play music on his old fiddle. Soon he was traveling the area to listen to music and talk with many of the accomplished fiddlers. In his humble and friendly way, he became generally interested in learning the background and interests of every musician he met. Although he was not a great fiddler himself, he made many friends in this pursuit. He attended competitions and soon became known to the country music fans in the eastern part of the United States as Uncle George the Fiddle Scraper from Kinzua County. When we heard Uncle George, he was 72 and enjoying every minute of his life. By having a sustained interest in other people, he created a new life for himself at a time when most people consider their productive years over. That, too, was one of the secrets of Theodore Roosevelt's astonishing popularity. Even his servants loved him. His valet, James E. Amos, wrote a book about him entitled Theodore Roosevelt, Hero to His Valet. In that book, Amos relates this illuminating incident. My wife one time asked the president about a Bob White. She'd never seen one, and he described it to her fully. And sometime later, the telephone at our cottage rang. Amos and his wife lived in a little cottage on the Roosevelt estate at Oyster Bay. My wife answered it, and it was Mr. Roosevelt himself. He'd called her, he said, to tell her that there was a Bob White outside her window, and if she would look out, she might see it. Little things like that were so characteristic of him. Whenever he went by our cottage, even though we were out of sight, we'd hear him call out, "Oh, Annie! Oh, James!" And just a friendly greeting as he went by. How could employees keep from liking a man like that? How could anyone keep from liking him? Roosevelt called at the White House one day when President and Mrs. Taft were away. His honest liking for humble people was shown by the fact that he greeted all the old White House servants by name, even the scullery maids. When he saw Alice, the kitchen maid, writes Archie Butt, he asked her if she still made cornbread. Alice told him that she sometimes made it for the servants, but no one ate it upstairs. "They show bad taste," Roosevelt boomed, "and I'll tell the president so when I see him." Alice brought a piece to him on a plate, and he went over to the office, eating it as he went and greeting gardeners and laborers as he passed. He addressed each person just as he had addressed them in the past. Ike Hoover, who had been head usher at the White House for 40 years, said with tears in his eyes, "It's the only happy day we had here in nearly 2 years, and not one of us would exchange it for a $100 bill. The same concern for the seemingly unimportant people helped sales representative Edward M. Sykes, Jr. of Chatham, New Jersey, retain an account. "Many years ago," he reported, "I called on customers for Johnson & Johnson in the Massachusetts area. One account was a drugstore in Hingham. Whenever I went into this store, I would always talk to the soda clerk and sales clerk for a few minutes before talking to the owner to obtain his order. One day, I went up to the owner of the store, and he told me to leave as he was not interested in buying J&J products anymore because he felt they were concentrating their activities on food and discount stores to the detriment of small drugstores. I left with my tail between my legs and drove around the town for several hours. Finally, I decided to go back and try at least to explain our position to the owner of the store. When I returned, I walked in and, as usual, said hello to the soda clerk and sales clerk. When I walked up to the owner, he smiled at me and welcomed me back. He then gave me double the usual order. I looked at him with surprise and asked him what had happened since my visit only a few hours earlier. He pointed to the young man at the soda fountain and said that after I had left, the boy had come over and said that I was one of the few salespeople that called on the store that even bothered to say hello to him and to the others in the store. He told the owner that if any salesperson deserved his business, it was I. The owner agreed and remained a loyal customer. I never forgot that to be genuinely interested in other people is a most important quality for a salesperson to possess, for any person, for that matter. I have discovered from personal experience that one can win the attention and time and cooperation of even the most sought-after people by becoming genuinely interested in them. Let me illustrate. Years ago, I conducted a course in fiction writing at the Brooklyn Institute of Arts and Sciences, and we wanted such distinguished and busy authors as Kathleen Norris, Fanny Hurst, Ida Tarbell, Albert Payson Terhune, and Rupert Hughes to come to Brooklyn and give us the benefit of their experiences. So we wrote them, saying we admired their work and were deeply interested in getting their advice and learning the secrets of their success. Each of these letters was signed by about 150 students. We said we realized that these authors were busy, too busy to prepare a lecture, so we enclosed a list of questions for them to answer about themselves and their methods of work. They liked that. Who wouldn't like it? So they left their homes and traveled to Brooklyn to give us a helping hand. By using the same method, I persuaded Leslie M. Shaw, Secretary of the Treasury in Theodore Roosevelt's cabinet, George W. Wickersham, Attorney General in Taft's cabinet, William Jennings Bryan, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and many other prominent men to come to talk to the students of my courses in public speaking. All of us, be we workers in a factory, clerks in an office, or even a king upon his throne, all of us like people who admire us. Take the German Kaiser, for example. At the close of World War I, he was probably the most savagely and universally despised man on this earth. Even his own nation turned against him when he fled over into Holland to save his neck. The hatred against him was so intense that millions of people would have loved to tear him limb from limb or burn him at the stake. In the midst of all this forest fire of fury, one little boy wrote the Kaiser a simple, sincere letter, glowing with kindliness and admiration. This little boy said that no matter what the others thought, he would always love Wilhelm as his emperor. The Kaiser was deeply touched by his letter and invited the little boy to come see him. The boy came, so did his mother, and the Kaiser married her. That little boy didn't need to read a book on how to win friends and influence people. He knew how instinctively. If we want to make friends, let's put ourselves out to do things for other people, things that require time, energy, unselfishness, and thoughtfulness. When the Duke of Windsor was Prince of Wales, he was scheduled to tour South America. And before he started out on that tour, he spent months studying Spanish so that he could make public talks in the language of the country. And the South Americans loved him for it. For years, I made it a point to find out the birthdays of my friends. How? Although I haven't the foggiest bit of faith in astrology, I began by asking the other party whether he believed the date of one's birth had anything to do with character and disposition. I then asked him or her to tell me the month and day of birth. If he or she said November 24th, for example, I kept repeating to myself, November 24th, November 24th. The minute my friend's back was turned, I wrote down the name and birthday, and later would transfer it to a birthday book. At the beginning of each year, I had these birthday dates scheduled in my calendar pad so that they came to my attention automatically. When the natal day arrived, there was my letter or telegram. What a hit it made! I was frequently the only person on earth who remembered. If we want to make friends, let's greet people with animation and enthusiasm. When somebody calls you on the telephone, use the same psychology. Say hello in tones that bespeak how pleased you are to have the other person call. Many companies train their telephone operators to greet all callers in a tone of voice that radiates interest and enthusiasm. The caller feels the company is concerned about them. Let's remember that when we answer the telephone tomorrow. Showing a genuine interest in others not only wins friends for you, but may develop in its customers a loyalty to your company. In an issue of the publication of the National Bank of North America of New York, the following letter from Madeline Rosedale, a depositor, was published. I would like you to know how much I appreciate your staff. Everyone is so courteous, polite, and helpful. What a pleasure it is, after waiting on a long line, to have the teller greet you pleasantly. Last year, my mother was hospitalized for 5 months. Frequently, I went to Marie Petrosello, a teller. She was concerned about my mother and inquired about her progress. Is there any doubt that Mrs. Rosedale will continue to use this bank? Charles R. Walters, of one of the large banks in New York City, was assigned to prepare a confidential report on a certain corporation. He knew of only one person who possessed the facts he needed so urgently. As Mr. Walters was ushered into the president's office, a young woman stuck her head through a door and told the president that she didn't have any stamps for him that day. I'm collecting stamps for my 12-year-old son, the president explained to Mr. Walters. Mr. Walters stated his mission and began asking questions. The president was vague, general, nebulous. He didn't want to talk, and apparently nothing could persuade him to talk. The interview was brief and barren. "Frankly, I didn't know what to do," Mr. Walters said, as he related this story to the class. Then I remembered what his secretary had said to him. Stamps, 12-year-old son. I also recalled that the Foreign Department of our bank collected stamps. Stamps taken from letters pouring in from every continent washed by the seven seas. The next afternoon, I called on this man and sent in word that I had some stamps for his boy. Was I ushered in with enthusiasm? Yes, sir. He couldn't have shaken my hand with more enthusiasm if he'd been running for Congress. He radiated smiles and goodwill. "Oh, my George will love this one," he kept saying as he fondled the stamps. "Look at this. This is a treasure." And we spent half an hour talking stamps and looking at the picture of his boy, and then he devoted more than an hour of his time to giving me every bit of information I wanted without my even suggesting that he do it. He told me all he knew, and then he called in his subordinates and questioned them. He telephoned some of his associates. He loaded me down with facts, figures, reports, and correspondence. In the parlance of newspaper reporters, I had a scoop. Here's another illustration. C.M. Napoli, Jr. of Philadelphia had tried for years to sell fuel to a large chain store organization. But the chain store company continued to purchase its fuel from an out-of-town dealer and haul it right past the door of Napoli's office. Mr. Napoli made a speech one night before one of my classes, pouring out his hot wrath upon chain stores, branding them as a curse to the nation. And still he wondered why he couldn't sell them. I suggested that he try different tactics. To put it briefly, and this is what happened. We staged a debate between members of the course on whether the spread of the chain store is doing the country more harm than good. Napoli, at my suggestion, took the negative side. He agreed to defend the chain stores, and then went straight to an executive of the chain store organization that he despised and said, "I am not here to try to sell fuel. I've come to ask you to do me a favor." He then told about his debate and said, "I've come to you for help because I can't think of anyone else who would be more capable of giving me the facts I want. I'm anxious to win this debate, and I'll deeply appreciate whatever help you can give me." And here's the rest of the story in Mr. Napoli's own words. "I asked this man for precisely 1 minute of his time. It was with that understanding that he consented to see me. After I'd stated my case, he motioned me to the chair and talked to me for exactly 1 hour and 47 minutes. He called in another executive who'd written a book on chain stores. He wrote to the National Chain Store Association and secured for me a copy of a debate on the subject. He feels that the chain store is rendering a real service to humanity. He's proud of what he's doing for hundreds of communities. His eyes fairly glowed as he talked, and I must confess that he opened my eyes to things I'd never even dreamed of. He changed my whole mental attitude. As I was leaving, he walked with me to the door, put his arm around my shoulder, wished me well in my debate, and asked me to stop in and see him again and let him know how I made out. The last words he said to me were, 'Please see me again later in the spring. I should like to place an order with you for fuel.' To me, that was almost a miracle. Here he was, offering to buy fuel without my even suggesting it. I had made more headway in 2 hours by becoming genuinely interested in him and his problems than I could have made in 10 years trying to get him interested in me and my product." Now, you didn't discover a new truth, Mr. Napoli. For a long time ago, 100 years before Christ was born, a famous old Roman poet, Publilius Syrus, remarked, "We are interested in others when they are interested in us." A show of interest, as with every other principle of human relations, must be sincere. It must pay off not only for the person showing the interest, but for the person receiving the attention. It is a two-way street. Both parties benefit. Martin Ginsburg, who took our course in Long Island, New York, reported how the special interest a nurse took in him profoundly affected his life. "It was Thanksgiving Day, and I was 10 years old. I was in a welfare ward of a city hospital and was scheduled to undergo major orthopedic surgery the next day. I knew that I could only look forward to months of confinement, convalescence, and pain. My father was dead. My mother and I lived alone in a small apartment, and we were on welfare. My mother was unable to visit me that day, As the day went on, I became overwhelmed with a feeling of loneliness, despair, fear. I knew my mother was home alone, worrying about me, not having anyone to be with, not having anyone to eat with, not even having enough money to afford a Thanksgiving Day dinner. And the tears welled up in my eyes, and I stuck my head under the pillow and pulled the covers over it. I cried silently, but oh, so bitterly, so much that my body was racked with pain. A young student nurse heard my sobbing and came over to me. She took the covers off my face and started wiping my tears. She told me how lonely she was, having to work that day, not being able to be with her family. She asked me whether I'd have dinner with her. She brought two trays of food, sliced turkey, mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, and ice cream for dessert. She talked to me and tried to calm my fears. Even though she was scheduled to go off duty at 4 p.m., she stayed on her own time until almost 11 p.m. She played games with me, talked to me, and stayed with me until I finally fell asleep. Many Thanksgivings have come and gone since I was 10, but one never passes without me remembering that particular one, and my feelings of frustration, fear, loneliness, and the warmth and tenderness of the stranger that somehow made it all bearable. If you want others to like you, if you want to develop real friendships, if you want to help others at the same time as you help yourself, keep this principle in mind. Principle 1. Become genuinely interested in other people. Chapter 2. A simple way to make a good first impression. At a dinner party in New York, one of the guests, a woman who had inherited money, was eager to make a pleasing impression on everyone. She had squandered a modest fortune on sables, diamonds, and pearls, but she hadn't done anything whatever about her face. It radiated sourness and selfishness. She didn't realize what everyone knows, namely that the expression one wears on one's face is far more important than the clothes one wears on one's back. Charles Schwab told me his smile had been worth $1 million, and he was probably understating the truth. For Schwab's personality, his charm, his ability to make people like him, were almost wholly responsible for his extraordinary success. And one of the most delightful factors in his personality was his captivating smile. Actions speak louder than words, and a smile says, "I like you, you make me happy, I'm glad to see you." That's why dogs make such a hit. They're so glad to see us that they almost jump out of their skins, so naturally we're glad to see them. A baby's smile has the same effect. Have you ever been in a doctor's waiting room and looked around at all the glum faces waiting impatiently to be seen? Dr. Stephen K. Spruill, a veterinarian in Raytown, Missouri, told of a typical spring day when his waiting room was full of clients waiting to have their pets inoculated. No one was talking to anyone else, and all were probably thinking of a dozen other things they'd rather be doing than wasting time sitting in that office. He told one of our classes, "There were 6 or 7 clients waiting when a young woman came in with a 9-month-old baby and a kitten. As luck would have it, she sat down next to a gentleman who was more than a little distraught about the long wait for service. The next thing he knew, the baby just looked up at him with that great big smile that's so characteristic of babies. And what did the gentleman do? Just what you and I would do, of course. He smiled back at the baby. Soon he struck up a conversation with the woman about her baby and his grandchildren, and soon the entire reception room joined in, and the boredom and tension were converted into a pleasant and enjoyable experience." Professor James V. McConnell, a psychologist at the University of Michigan, expressed his feelings about a smile. "People who smile," he said, "tend to manage, teach, and sell more effectively, and to raise happier children. There's far more information in a smile than a frown. That's why encouragement is a much more effective teaching device than punishment." The employment manager of a large New York department store told me she'd rather hire a sales clerk who hadn't finished grade school, if he or she has a pleasant smile, than to hire a doctor of philosophy with a somber face. The effect of a smile is powerful, even when it's unseen. telephone companies throughout the United States have a program called Phone Power, which is offered to employees who use the telephone for selling their services or products. In this program, they suggest that you smile when talking on the phone. Your smile comes through in your voice. Robert Cryer, manager of a computer department for a Cincinnati, Ohio company, told me how he had successfully found the right applicant for a hard-to-fill position. "I was desperately trying to recruit a Ph.D. in computer science for my department. I finally located a young man with ideal qualifications who was about to be graduated from Purdue University. After several phone conversations, I learned that he had had several offers from other companies, many of them larger and better known than mine. I was delighted when he accepted my offer. After he started on the job, I asked him why he had chosen us over the others. He paused for a moment, and then he said, 'I think it was because managers in the other companies spoke on the phone in a cold, businesslike manner, which made me feel like just another business transaction. Your voice sounded as if you were glad to hear from me, that you really wanted me to be a part of your organization. You can be assured I am still answering my phone with a smile.'" The chairman of the board of directors of one of the largest rubber companies in the United States told me that, according to his observations, people rarely succeed at anything unless they have fun doing it. This industrial leader doesn't put much faith in the old adage that hard work alone is the magic key that will unlock the door to our desires. "I have known people," he said, "who succeeded because they had a rip-roaring good time conducting their business. Later, I saw those people change as the fun became work. The business had grown dull, they lost all joy in it, and they failed." You must have a good time meeting people if you expect them to have a good time meeting you. I've asked thousands of business people to smile at someone every hour of the day for a week and then come to class and talk about the results. How did it work? Let's see. Here's a letter from William B. Steinhardt, a New York stockbroker. His case isn't isolated. In fact, it's typical of hundreds of cases. "I've been married for over 18 years," wrote Mr. Steinhardt. "In all that time, I seldom smiled at my wife or spoke 24 words to her from the time I got up until I was ready to leave for business. I was one of the worst grouches who ever walked down Broadway. When you asked me to make a talk about my experience with smiles, I thought I'd try it for a week. So the next morning, while combing my hair, I looked at my glum mug in the mirror and I said to myself, 'Bill, you're going to wipe the scowl off that sourpuss of yours today. You are going to smile. And you are going to begin right now.' As I sat down to breakfast, I greeted my wife with a 'Good morning, my dear,' and smiled as I said it. You warned me that she might be surprised. Well, you underestimated her reaction. She was bewildered. She was shocked. I told her that in the future she could expect this as a regular occurrence, and I kept it up every morning. This changed attitude of mine brought more happiness into our home in 2 months since I started than was there during the last year. As I leave for my office, I greet the elevator operator in the apartment house with a 'Good morning,' and a smile. I greet the doorman with a smile. I smile at the cashier in the subway booth when I ask for change. As I stand on the floor of the stock exchange, I smile at people who until recently never saw me smile. I soon found that everybody was smiling back at me. I treat those who come to me with complaints or grievances in a cheerful manner. I smile as I listen to them, and I find that adjustments are accomplished much easier. I find that smiles are bringing me dollars, many dollars, every day. I share my office with another broker. One of his clerks is a likable young chap. I was so elated about the results I was getting that I told him recently about my new philosophy of human relations. He then confessed that when I first came to share my office with his firm, he thought me a terrible grouch, and only recently changed his mind. He said I was really human when I smiled. I have also eliminated criticism from my system. I give appreciation and praise now instead of condemnation. I have stopped talking about what I want. I am now trying to see the other person's viewpoint, and these things have literally revolutionized my life. I am a totally different man, a happier man, a richer man, richer in friendships and happiness, the only things that matter much after all." You don't feel like smiling? And then what? two things. First, force yourself to smile. If you're alone, force yourself to whistle or hum a tune or sing. Act as if you were already happy, and that will tend to make you happy. Here's the way the psychologist and philosopher William James puts it. Action seems to follow feeling, but really action and feeling go together. And by regulating the action, which is under the more direct control of the will, we can indirectly regulate the feeling, which is not. Thus, the sovereign voluntary path to cheerfulness, if our cheerfulness be lost, is to sit up cheerfully and to act and speak as if cheerfulness were already there. Everybody in the world is seeking happiness, and there's only one sure way to find it. That is, by controlling your thoughts. Happiness doesn't depend on outward conditions. It depends on inner conditions. It isn't what you have or who you are or where you are or what you're doing that makes you happy or unhappy. It is what you think about it. For example, two people may be in the same place doing the same thing. Both may have about an equal amount of money and prestige, and yet one may be miserable and the other happy. Why? Because of a different mental attitude. I have seen just as many happy faces among the poor peasants toiling with their primitive tools in the devastating heat of the tropics as I have seen in air-conditioned offices in New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles. There is nothing either good or bad, said Shakespeare, but thinking makes it so. Abe Lincoln once remarked that most folks are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. He was right. I saw a vivid illustration of that truth as I was walking up the stairs of the Long Island Railroad Station in New York. Directly in front of me, 30 or 40 crippled boys on canes and crutches were struggling up the stairs. One boy had to be carried up. I was astonished at their laughter and gaiety. I spoke about it to one of the men in charge of the boys. Oh, yes, he said. When a boy realizes that he's going to be a cripple for life, he's shocked at first. But after he gets over the shock, he usually resigns himself to his fate and then becomes as happy as normal boys. I felt like taking my hat off to those boys. They taught me a lesson I hope I shall never forget. Working all by oneself in a closed-off room in an office not only is lonely, but it denies one the opportunity of making friends with other employees in the company. Senora Maria Gonzalez of Guadalajara, Mexico, had such a job. She envied the shared comradeship of other people in the company as she heard their chatter and laughter. As she passed them in the hall during the first weeks of her employment, she shyly looked the other way. After a few weeks, she said to herself, "Maria, you can't expect these women to come to you. You have to go out and meet them." The next time she walked to the water cooler, she put on her brightest smile and said, "Hi, how are you today?" to each of the people she met. The effect was immediate. Smiles and hellos were returned. The hallway seemed brighter, the job friendlier. Acquaintanceships developed, and some ripened into friendships. Her job and her life became more pleasant and interesting. Peruse this bit of sage advice from the essayist and publisher Albert Hubbard, but remember, perusing it won't do you any good unless you apply it. Whenever you go out of doors, draw the chin in, carry the crown of the head high, and fill the lungs to the utmost. Drink in the sunshine, greet your friends with a smile, and put soul into every hand clasp. Do not fear being misunderstood, and do not waste a minute thinking about your enemies. Try to fix firmly in your mind what you would like to do, and then, without veering off direction, you will move straight to the goal. Keep your mind on the great and splendid things you would like to do, and then, as the days go gliding away, you will find yourself unconsciously seizing upon the opportunities that are required for the fulfillment of your desire, just as the coral insect takes from the running tide the element it needs. Picture in your mind the able, earnest, useful person you desire to be, and the thought you hold is hourly transforming you into that particular individual. Thought is supreme. Preserve a right mental attitude. The attitude of courage, frankness, and good cheer. To think rightly is to create. All things come through desire, and every sincere prayer is answered. We become like that on which our hearts are fixed. Carry your chin in and the crown of your head high. We are gods in the chrysalis. The ancient Chinese were a wise lot, wise in the ways of the world. and they had a proverb that you and I ought to cut out and paste inside our hats. It goes like this. A man without a smiling face must not open a shop. Your smile is a messenger of your goodwill. Your smile brightens the lives of all who see it. To someone who has seen a dozen people frown, scowl, or turn their faces away, your smile is like the sun breaking through the clouds, especially when that someone is under pressure from his bosses, his customers, his teachers, or parents, or children. A smile can help him realize that all is not hopeless, that there is joy in the world. Some years ago, a department store in New York City, in recognition of the pressures its sales clerks were under during the Christmas rush, presented the readers of its advertisements with the following homely philosophy. The value of a smile at Christmas. It costs nothing but creates much. It enriches those who receive without impoverishing those who give. It happens in a flash, and the memory of it sometimes lasts forever. None are so rich they can get along without it, and none so poor but are richer for its benefits. It creates happiness in the home, fosters goodwill in the business, and is the countersign of friends. It is rest to the weary, daylight to the discouraged, sunshine to the sad, and nature's best antidote for trouble. Yet it cannot be bought, begged, borrowed, or stolen, for it is something that is no earthly good to anybody until it is given away. And if, in the last-minute rush of Christmas buying, some of our salespeople should be too tired to give you a smile, may we ask you to leave one of yours? For nobody needs a smile so much as those who have none left to give. Principle 2. Smile. Chapter 3. If you don't do this, you are headed for trouble. Back in 1898, a tragic thing happened in Rockland County, New York. A child had died, and on this particular day, the neighbors were preparing to go to the funeral. Jim Farley went out to the barn to hitch up his horse. The ground was covered with snow, the air was cold and snappy, the horse hadn't been exercised for days, and as he was led out to the watering trough, he wheeled playfully, kicked both his heels high in the air, and killed Jim Farley. So the little village of Stony Point had two funerals that week instead of one. Jim Farley left behind him a widow and three boys, and a few $100 in insurance. His oldest boy, Jim, was 10, and he went to work in a brickyard, wheeling sand and pouring it in the molds and turning the bricks on edge to be dried by the sun. This boy, Jim, never had a chance to get much education, but with his natural geniality, he had a flair for making people like him, so he went into politics, and as the years went by, he developed an uncanny ability for remembering people's names. He never saw the inside of a high school, but before he was 46 years of age, four colleges had honored him with degrees, and he'd become chairman of the Democratic National Committee and Postmaster General of the United States. I once interviewed Jim Farley and asked him the secret of his success. He said, "Hard work." And I said, "Don't be funny." He then asked me what I thought was the reason for his success. I replied, "I understand you can call 10,000 people by their first names." "No, you're wrong," he said. "I can call 50,000 people by their first names." And make no mistake about it, that ability helped Mr. Farley put Franklin D. Roosevelt in the White House when he managed Roosevelt's campaign in 1932. During the years that Jim Farley traveled as a salesman for a gypsum concern, and during the years that he held office as town clerk in Stony Point, he built up a system for remembering names. In the beginning, it was a very simple one. Whenever he met a new acquaintance, he found out his or her complete name and some facts about his or her family, business, and political opinions. He fixed all these facts well in mind as part of the picture, and then the next time he met that person, even if it was a year later, he was able to shake hands, inquire after the family, and ask about the hollyhocks in the backyard. No wonder he developed a following. For months before Roosevelt's campaign for president began, Jim Farley wrote hundreds of letters a day to people all over the western and northwestern states. Then he hopped onto a train and in 19 days covered 20 states and 12,000 miles, traveling by buggy, train, automobile, and boat. He would drop into town, meet his people at lunch or breakfast, tea or dinner, and give them a heart-to-heart talk. Then he'd dash off again on another leg of his journey. As soon as he arrived back east, he wrote to one person in each town he had visited, asking for a list of all the guests to whom he had talked. The final list contained thousands and thousands of names, yet each person on that list was paid the subtle flattery of getting a personal letter from James Farley. These letters began, "Dear Bill," or "Dear Jane," and they were always signed, "Jim." Jim Farley discovered, early in life, that the average person is more interested in his or her own name than in all the other names on earth put together. Remember that name and call it easily, and you have paid a subtle and very effective compliment. But forget it or misspell it, and you've placed yourself at a sharp disadvantage. For example, I once organized a public speaking course in Paris and sent form letters to all the American residents in the city. French typists, with apparently little knowledge of English, filled in the names, and naturally they made blunders. One man, the manager of a large American bank in Paris, wrote me a scathing rebuke because his name had been misspelled. Sometimes it's difficult to remember a name, particularly if it's hard to pronounce. Rather than even try to learn it, many people ignore it or call the person by an easy nickname. Sid Levy once called on a customer for some time whose name was Nicodemus Papadoulos. Most people just called him Nick. Levy told us, "I made a special effort to say his name over several times to myself before I made a call. When I greeted him by his full name, 'Good afternoon, Mr. Nicodemus Papadoulos,' he was shocked. For what seemed like several minutes, there was no reply from him at all. Finally, he said, with tears rolling down his cheeks, 'Mr. Levy, in all the 15 years I have been in this country, nobody has ever made the effort to call me by my right name.'" And what was the reason for Andrew Carnegie's success? He was called the Steel King, yet he himself knew little about the manufacture of steel. He had hundreds of people working for him who knew far more about steel than he did. But he knew how to handle people, and that is what made him rich. Early in life, he showed a flair for organization, a genius for leadership. By the time he was 10, he too had discovered the astounding importance people place on their own name. And he used that discovery to win cooperation. To illustrate, when he was a boy back in Scotland, he got a hold of a rabbit, a mother rabbit. Presto, he soon had a whole nest of little rabbits and nothing to feed them. But he had a brilliant idea. He told the boys and girls in the neighborhood that if they would go out and pull enough clover and dandelions to feed the rabbits, he would name the bunnies in their honor. The plan worked like magic, and Carnegie never forgot it. Years later, he made millions by using the same psychology in business. For example, he wanted to sell steel rails to the Pennsylvania Railroad. J. Edgar Thomson was the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad then, so Andrew Carnegie built a huge steel mill in Pittsburgh and called it the Edgar Thomson Steel Works. Now here's a riddle. See if you can guess it. When the Pennsylvania Railroad needed steel rails, where do you suppose J. Edgar Thomson bought them? From Sears Roebuck? No. No, you're wrong. Guess again. When Andrew Carnegie and George Pullman were battling each other for supremacy in the railroad sleeping car business, the Steel King again remembered the lesson of the rabbits. The Central Transportation Company, which Andrew Carnegie controlled, was fighting with the company that Pullman owned. Both were struggling to get the sleeping car business of the Union Pacific Railroad, bucking each other, slashing prices, and destroying all chance of profit. Both Carnegie and Pullman had gone to New York to see the board of directors of the Union Pacific. Meeting one evening in the St. Nicholas Hotel, Carnegie said, "Good evening, Mr. Pullman. Aren't we making a couple of fools of ourselves?" "What do you mean?" Pullman demanded. And then Carnegie expressed what he had on his mind, a merger of their two interests. He pictured in glowing terms the mutual advantages of working with instead of against each other. Pullman listened attentively, but he was not wholly convinced. Finally, he asked, "What would you call the new company?" And Carnegie replied promptly, "Why, the Pullman Palace Car Company, of course." Pullman's face brightened. "Come into my room," he said. "Let's talk it over." And that talk made industrial history. This policy of remembering and honoring the names of his friends and business associates was one of the secrets of Andrew Carnegie's leadership. He was proud of the fact that he could call many of his factory workers by their first names. And he boasted that while he was personally in charge, no strike ever disturbed his flaming steel mills. Benton Love, chairman of Texas Commerce Bank Shares, believes that the bigger a corporation gets, the colder it becomes. One way to warm it up, he said, is to remember people's names. The executive who tells me he can't remember names is at the same time telling me he can't remember a significant part of his business and is operating on quicksand. Karen Kirsch of Rancho Palos Verdes, California, a flight attendant for TWA, made it a practice to learn the names of as many passengers in her cabin as possible and use the name when serving them. This resulted in many compliments in her service, expressed both to her directly and to the airline. One passenger wrote, "I haven't flown TWA for some time, but I'm going to start flying nothing but TWA from now on. You make me feel that your airline has become a very personalized airline, and that's important to me."
Context of white supremacy. If you are interested in participating, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The free HD flash phone should be working as well if you want to use that. Knock yourself out. A new person that dialed in, our other two callers at 9325 and 7892, your line should be open as well. The person dialed in with a hand up who has not spoken yet, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yeah. I have a question for you, Gus. Has, greeting people ever, worked against you?
Greeting people?
Yeah. Like saying good morning or good evening or whatever. From anything like that.
Being courteous? No. I don't go out of my way to, speak to people and things of that. I generally try to leave people alone and just, stay to myself. But I do make an effort to be courteous. When I talk to people, I think I've said before, I make an effort to say ma'am and sir on a pretty regular basis and just things that I consider to be just common courtesies. I make an effort to do that at all times, as often as I can, even when I'm talking about racism, white supremacy, even if I'm talking to a white person. And I don't think it has resulted in harm. I think it has been constructive. I think it's been helpful for me in keeping situations from becoming more contentious. I've had some people who have pointed to that specifically and said that they thought that was helpful because I wasn't there. Accustomed to people talking about racism and getting loud and rowdy and name calling and that sort of thing. So, no, I can't say it has resulted in mistreatment.
All right, what do you do, right, when, you greet someone and they, completely ignore you?
Keep it moving. That's what I expect. I was thinking that because I was just under this system, it was years ago. I heard Mr. Fuller, this was before the Cows was on the air. And Mr. Fuller, he was on Alexis K. Tyler program, by the way, but he was a guest on her program, and he was saying, whenever you get up in the morning and you leave your house, do not ever expect correct treatment. And the context of him saying this was someone was saying that they went, I think she was Miss Tyler. She was telling him a story about she went someplace and they ended up throwing her out security and twisted her arm and blah, blah, blah. And he said, this is, this happens all day long. He said, it's happening right now. A black person is being snatched up and thrown out of some place, for whatever reason. This happens all day long, everywhere. And he said, I'll say it again, never expect correct treatment. So a non-white person or a white person not speaking to me, if I say good morning, good afternoon, whatever, and they don't speak, that's what I expect. I know what this is. Racism, white supremacy, keep it moving. That's the exact approach I take. If this is somebody that I'm going to be seeing on a regular basis and they, they don't want to communicate, no problem. That's fine. Minimize contact, minimize conflict. No problem if they don't want to speak. If this is a stranger, then this is not even worth, 30 milliseconds of my mental energy if this is just some random person on the plantation. So, yeah, that's next.
All right. Another question I have. The book, the person was talking, mentioned something about, like, holidays. I think it was Thanksgiving. And my question is, what if, like, you know, like, they have Thanksgiving up here and stuff, and, like, you don't want to, like, participate? Like, how can you, like, get out of that stuff? Like, Thanksgiving, Independence Day, all those holidays, without basically, like, hurting your family's or your friends' feelings?
You know, you can't control other people's feelings. They're going to feel however they feel. So if they have some sort of emotional investment in your participation in Thanksgiving, Christmas, blah, 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 you know, there's nothing you can really do about that other than, you know, be honest with yourself. You know, mom or dad, brother, whomever, they are going to be upset about this, and their anger will be manifested in, you know, whatever, name calling me, which some listeners have told me about that this has happened, that they stopped celebrating Christmas and they got nasty phone messages for their relatives were picking on them, and which is not surprising. I will go back to what Mr. Fuller said. Do not ever expect correct treatment. And if you get it, you can be appreciative. You can be sincerely appreciative, which he's been saying repeatedly, if you get it. But I mean, that way you won't be surprised, because it's just going to be happening over and over and over and over and over. And then you'll wake up and it'll be the same thing. It'll be Groundhog Day. So, you know, just acknowledge that. If they're going to be upset, you know, you have people that this means something to them, and you not doing it is, you know, going to be a problem, and they might be rowdy about it. You know, if you've decided you don't want to do this anymore, and that's the choice that you've made, then, you know, that's going to be a part of it. If that means, you know, I minimize contact with them, or if that means that I go and I have contact and I put up with whatever they're going to say about it, and I figure out, you know, if I might not need to say anything at all. I might, you know, figure out some questions or, you know, things to say to make sure it doesn't become conflict. But, yeah, you know, you just face reality of what it's going to be and make a decision about whether you're going to participate or not.
Okay.
If that makes sense, you know, I might be talking crazy, so other people...
No, but definitely makes sense, definitely. Yeah, thanks for your input.
Yes, ma'am. The person that called in at 2044. Is it all right if I ask the female caller? Are you calling from in the States? Is that all right to ask?
Yes, I am. Oh,
all right, just checking. You have an accent. I was.
Yes, hearing. I do. Yes.
Right on. Two zero four four. You should be with us as well. Last four digits, 2044.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Gus, and to the rest of the callers. I was calling because it's funny. Last week, after listening to the show, I actually went to a used bookstore looking for, you know, the book How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it was like a hole-in-the-wall type place, you know, not too many people in there, but it had tons of books. So, you know, the rate the suspect owner, you know, he was kind of looking at me because, you know, seeing a black, you know, guy walking throughout a bookstore looking for books, it's just not typical for him, I guess. So he came up and asked me, hey, what can I help you with? I'm like, I'm looking for Dale Carnegie's book. And he handed it to me, and, you know, I grabbed it, and I asked him, did he have a section that had black, you know, books, because I wanted to find out if they had any of, Yerugo or anything like that, you know. He pointed me to the black section in the bookstore, and of course, it was in the back of the, you know, all the way in the back of the bookstore, which was kind of funny to me. Anyway, as I was looking through the books, looking, you know, to see what they had a bunch of, you know, great deal of interesting books and stuff. So I went up to him and I asked him a little bit later on, hey, do you guys have any books on Lathrop Stoddard? And he kind of looked at me like, well, what do you, he's like, that guy's a racist. I said, yeah, I know. I'm just interested in the, you know, in his thought process. And he said, oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, I don't have any of his books, but, I do have one book. And then he leaves. He goes and he comes back and he hands me a book called The Dispossessed Majority by Wilmot Robertson. And this guy, it's a book in the same vein, I would imagine. I haven't read it, but I did purchase it from him. It's in the same vein of the Turner Diaries, I would imagine. And I just found it interesting that, you know, the guy, you know, he's like, don't tell anybody I gave this book to you. But anyway, I just wanted to share that story with you.
If anyone is ignorant about racism, it's black people.
Black people.
Black people.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you kindly for sharing. That is... That is astounding. Well, and again, you shouldn't be surprised about any aspect of it. The black stuff being in the back of the store. This white guy knowing about Lothrop. Now, this is just some random white guy who works at the bookstore. He knows about Lothrop Stoddard and others written on this subject matter. Yeah. Thank you for sharing, sir. That is outstanding. I'm glad you were able to get a copy. I'm not surprised. You can get it. You probably get that book for like a penny.
It was like $3.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Gus, I'd like to ask you a question. How did, I remember recently when we had the guy from military intelligence, and he had worked for the CIA, and he kept referring to you by your last name. And, you know, I don't know about the other callers, but that's the first time I had heard anyone call your complete name and using your last name more than once. What did you think about that? Did you think about it at all? And that guy must have did some research before he came on the show.
We had had correspondence before the program, not on the phone, but just we had been talking online for like a week or so. And I had been using Gus Lawrence online, and I think I had been calling him Mr. Furnish, and then I went to Dr. Furnish when I found out he's a doctor. And I think he was on guard about being perceived as a racist. And I had already made an issue about him potentially being dishonest. So I think he was kind of on the, I'm going to be on my best behavior and be courteous. And you're, you know, referencing me as Mr. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to use Mr. Carnegie's techniques and do the same. So I'm going to reference you as Mr. A few people have done that on the program. And I have even got the impression sometimes before that the white person was trying to, they were seeing that I was going to be courteous. So it becomes like a competition. I'm going to make sure that I'm as courteous as you are. I'm going to be right there where you are so that I'm not perceived as rude and trifling and that sort of thing. Like, I feel like I've been in conversations where that's happening. And I think that was going on there. Cause I, like what you said, like when he was calling me Mr. Lawrence during the program, I felt that's what was going on. Like, I'm going to be on my best behavior so that I am as courteous and composed as Mr. Lawrence, and I will not come across as racist or trifling, if that makes sense. I don't know. What were you thinking?
Okay. I was thinking that maybe he was trying to reveal your identity if you wanted anonymity or you wanted to be anonymous, and he was, you know, revealing to the public, you know, what your whole name was. I mean, you usually refer to, Mr. Fuller said, we should refer to someone what they want to be called. Mm-hmm. And unless you have given the person permission to call you by your full name or your whole name, it seems like he would just refer to you like everyone else is Gus.
I think I would have to look at my emails, but I think he did that in the emails as well, the Mr. Lawrence. And, like, I think he was doing it there, like I said, to bounce, like, that's what it felt like to me. Like, this guy is trained, he's been in the army and the whole nine. I felt like that was a part, and I mean, this guy's trained in linguistics, so I felt like that was a part of the refinement, that was a part of his code. Like, that's the way that I took it. And I had to look at my emails to confirm, but I think he was saying Mr. Lawrence the whole time. He just continued the way he had been referencing me in our previous dialogue.
Okay, well, that's fine. I was just wondering about that. Okay, part of my commentary would be on how names are important. In 2010, there was a female by the name of Kathleen M. Sullivan. She was one of the nation's top litigators and a former dean of the Stanford Law School. She had been the first lady, Michelle Obama's professor at Harvard. And she was being named as a partner in a law firm, and a prestigious firm. And I may not be correct, but I think that was groundbreaking, because there's not many women that are named partners and who get their names on a prestigious law firm's name. So someone's name is really important. And in other countries, people's name generally means something. That's not the case with us. We've taken on names that were former slave owners' name or names from the Bible. But that's my input as far as the names go.
Real important. I had heard that before, just about the importance of names, although I think that's always something that should be a good, something to be reminded of, to just making sure that using people's names and what have you, when you're talking to them. I think particularly for non-white people, that's another thing where I try to do sir, ma'am, mister, calling people by their last name, just to be courteous. It's been my experience that many non-white people do not experience that, where people just feel comfortable calling them by their first name and not showing them any respect as a quote-unquote man, quote-unquote woman. But that, I highlighted it because I thought it made the point that he was trying to make about the importance of names and even the racism, white supremacy indirectly. My pages aren't going to match up, but he says Jim Farley discovered early in life that the average person is more interested in his or her name or her own name than in all the other names on earth put together. Remember that name and call it easily, and you have paid a subtle and very effective compliment. But forget it or misspell it, and you have placed yourself at a sharp disadvantage. For example, I once organized a public speaking course in Paris and sent form letters to all the American residents in the city. French typists, which apparently little knowledge of English, filled in the names, and naturally they made blunders. One man, the manager of a large American bank in Paris, wrote me a scathing rebuke because his name had been misspelled. Sometimes it is difficult to remember a name, particularly if it is hard to pronounce, rather than even try to learn it. Many people ignore it or call the person by an easy nickname. I think this happens to a lot of non-white people who do not have Anglicanized names. I'm even thinking of President Obama. Continuing, Sid Levy called on a customer for some time whose name was Nicodemus Papadoulos. Most people just called him Nick. Levy told us, I made a special effort to say his name over several times to myself before I made my call. When I greeted him by his full name, Good morning, or excuse me, good afternoon, Mr. Nicodemus Papadopoulos. He was shocked. For what seemed like several minutes, there was no reply from him at all. Finally, he said, with tears rolling down his cheeks, Mr. Levy, in all the 15 years I have been in this country, nobody has ever made the effort to call me by my right name. Now, this might be Mr. Papadopoulos, might be a white person. I suspect this might be an individual who is not accepted as white. I could be wrong, but I know that this happens to non-white people who have names that are traditionally non-white names, names that are not associated with individuals classified as white, where this happens. Their names get butchered, they get all these corny, racist nicknames and that sort of thing, or just botched efforts at saying their name. Even a lot of black people, I'm sure, can attest to this happening all day long, and I don't think that it is done on accident. I think it's just white people being trifling because they know the significance of names. They've read Mr. Carnegie's work. But I thought that whole passage right there, important, and I think it revealed the racism. I'll mute my line.
I definitely agree with that. There's a couple coworkers I have and classmates that are from different areas of the world, and they come here to the States, and they're non-white people, and they will give themselves a quote-unquote European name in order for other people to communicate with them better. For example, I have a person who I am a colleague with, and his name is Inge. Pretty simple. He's from Ghana, but he goes by Walter. Walter, that has nothing to do with his name. He just goes by Walter because that is an easy name for white people to call him. So and to me, that's internalized form of anti-blackness in yourself, or just self-awareness in general. And it happens. It happens a lot. And white people are tricky, too. Even if you do have a simple name, they'll give you a nickname that they want to call you. So your name could be Frank, and they'll run around calling you Frankie all day. Like, they're just terrorists.
Yeah, that's why I have so much regard for, and that's why I think the trouble that Miss Hill is encountering, the black female victim of racism, artist, entertainer, and telling white people, you know, we are not friends. Do not take the liberty of just calling me by my first name like we're cool like that. And in fact, that and when in the book, when Mr. Carney is talking about walk with your chin up, because that's what that seems like to me, like a victim of racism, just any person. Setting boundaries about how they want to be treated, what they want to be called, being clear about their title and their name, taking pride in how they're going to be recognized and identified by others. That's taking pride. That's having your chin up. As he talks about, when you go out into the world, to be confident, have self-respect, Dr. Welsing, self-respect, weapon of mass destruction. And I was thinking, even in the book, you would be classified as an uppity nigger. Like, I want to go back and get the passage specifically. Oh, this is it. He says, whenever you go out of doors, draw the chin in, carry the crown of the head high, and fill the lungs to the utmost. Drink in the sunshine, greet your friends with a smile, and put soul into every hand clasp. I thought that was, wow. I don't know what that means. Do not fear being misunderstood, and do not waste a minute thinking about your enemies. Try to fix firmly in your mind what you would like to do, and then, without veering off direction, you will move straight to the goal. Keep your mind on the great and splendid things you would like to do, and then, as the days go gliding away, you will find yourself unconsciously seizing upon the opportunities that are required for the fulfillment of your desire. Just as the coral insect takes from the running tide the element it needs, picture in your mind the able, earnest, useful person you desire to be, and the thought you hold is hourly transforming you into that particular individual. Thought is supreme. Preserve a right mental attitude, the attitude of courage, frankness, and good cheer. To think rightly is to create. All things come through desire, and every sincere prayer is answered. We become like that on which our hearts are fixed. Carry your chin in and the crown of your head high. We are gods in the chrysalis. Now, when I heard that, I thought, now, if you are a non-white person and you do this, white people are probably going to think that you're uppity. Just like that. Not even saying that anything is incorrect about that. I would probably tweak a few things here and there, just because I think as non-white people, we kind of got to make sure that we keep in mind that we do have enemies. I think that's where a lot of us run into trouble, functioning as if we do not have enemies on the planet. So I would tweak a few things, but I think some of this could definitely be applicable to non-white people. But just, I would also, because we have enemies, they will most likely, you are uppity, you are arrogant, you are a sassy nigger walking around here with your chin up, thinking well of yourself, talking about your name is important. You are some kind of uppity nigger. I'll mute my line.
Yes,
can I go through? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, very good. Good evening and greetings to everyone out there. I wanted to share a job tip. I've worked in either a professional or a management position in many different settings, and all of them have been healthcare settings. So in the lower level of hospitals, you have the housekeeping staff, the people who sterilize the equipment. And I would say 90% of those people are going to be non-white black people. And I always made a point to, or I always make a point to greet them, learn their names, so on and so forth. And they would be quite surprised that someone at my level of working was wanting to know them. And I made friends with them. And what I found out about people at that level is they are a wealth of information about the politics of the organizations, because they become almost invisible people. They get a chance to hear all kinds of secrets that are going on. So I was always privy to information about layoffs coming up, people who were looking to be fired, so on and so forth, before the announcements were made. So I'm just letting everybody know that making friends with housekeeping and the so-called lower-level staff can be a good thing politically. I mute my line.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me of Melba Vitella Bill's story of the black male angel who worked at the hospital that saved her life, gave the information to her mom about the Epsom salts. I think a lot of times when we're in those, you know, positions for jobs, we are seen as invisible, and we do collect a lot of information. A lot of times that's helped us keep those jobs, too. So very good tip. Thanks for that.
Yes, one other thing that I can add there, I worked a management position where they moved a cardiologist in, and he just did not like me. And he worked it where I lost my office that I had, and they put me in an office way off to the side. And when I went into the office, I was appalled. It was dirty. The blinds were raggedy, and it just was a, as they call it here in Nashville, a hot mess. And my housekeeping friends, within a week, I had a fresh painted, new blinds, new carpeting, and beautiful furniture in my office. And, of course, I had to keep that office kind of a secret. So whenever someone wanted to meet with me, I would meet in their space and not in mine. But that was a one anecdote of a situation in which it really helped me to know my people. And as you guys were saying, I always address them by their last name, especially the elders. They deserve our respect.
Ashe. I have found that has been a big plus, too, in different work situations, just being, if you cannot be in conflict with some of the other non-white people on your job or in other places, it can really be a big benefit. Just they will know things about the job that you don't, other information, like it can work nicely if you all are not in conflict and can, you know, be constructive And I think just simple things like that, calling people Mr. Johnson, Mrs. Taylor, whatever, just something as simple as that. Speak, how are you doing? Simple things, birthdays, little things like that. I'm not into birthdays, but, you know, just little things like that can have such a huge impact. And I want to make sure I don't forget that segment where the white person, Mr. Papadoulos, where he was saying he called this guy by his name and he would practice it and make sure. And Mr. Papadoulos was in tears and talking about how people just called him by a nickname. That's an example about what I mean about how white people can be devastating with their skillful use of words, where they can come in and just with a few little trifle courtesies and have that non-white person eating out of their hand and thinking that this is, you know, Jesus the Messiah himself, certainly not a racist.
Yes, and piggybacking off of that, the part where the president, Mr. Roosevelt, was continuing to call out the servant's name every time he passed by their residence, to me that would get on my nerves. But, you know, I saw a movie once. It was called Behind the Stairs at the White House, and it was about all the servants that worked at the White House, and the way that they were treated was atrocious. They actually had white people in charge of them, although they did all of the work. But they were never in the management type position. And it wouldn't be anything special for them, for the presidents or the staff people to know their names, because they did everything in the White House over those years. They took care of the entire house for years and years. And some of the maids passed it on to their daughters and their families. So it was generations that worked in the White House.
What's the name of that movie again?
I believe the name was Backstairs of the White House. If you would Google that, it'll come up. Leslie Odoms was in, and pretty good movie. Gives you sort of an insight on what was happening inside of the White House with servants.
Is this a television program?
No, that's a movie.
Oh, okay. There's a television program called Backstairs at the White House that came out in the 70s. It's a TV miniseries.
Miniseries, okay. Yeah, that's it.
Oh, okay. With Lou Gossett Jr.? Is he in it? You
yeah.
Remember? Oh, okay. Okay. It looks like it's online. It looks like it's on YouTube. I don't know if it's the whole thing, but it looks like if it's not the whole thing, they have a lot of it. Like, it looks like they got 2.5 hours worth of it. Okay, this is not the whole thing. Well, at least they got 2.5 hours of it on YouTube. I'll put it on my Facebook page, but it's Backstairs at the White House. It's a mini series, and they have a good chunk of it on YouTube. I'm posting it right now. We did our three. Does anybody have any final sentences they want to get in before we wrap things up? And if anyone wants to do the prayer, you can be thinking of that now. But any final sentence anybody want to get in before we wrap up?
I did have one quick thing about the naming, using names to highlight things. I think white people have done a good job with Martin Luther King Boulevard and having and deceiving us into quote-unquote equality and By naming streets Martin Luther King Boulevard has kind of, you know, pulled the wool over our eyes, so to say. So I thought that was something that was important to highlight as well.
One last thing. When they mentioned Kaiser in Germany, they used Wilhelm, and it's actually with a W, but the W has a V sound in Germany. That was throwing me off at first. And you wouldn't know that that guy was hated because there's a lot of streets named after him and a lot of different places of honor that is named after that particular Kaiser.
Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal is in the top right corner. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. New blog post up on the Kevin Durant NBA Sprint commercial, picking out some of the racist aspects. New post just put up yesterday on the blog. Quickly, before we get out of here, The Dispossessed Majority, I just downloaded it. It's available online. You can get it as a PDF, full book. I will put it on my Facebook page. This is from the Flap. This tells you a lot. It's even interesting that he would suggest such a book like this. It says, this is written by Wilmot Robertson. I don't know if this is a white or non-white person, but it says, wait a minute. Just muting because I'm picking up a little background noise. Okay. It says, sick to the point of moral disintegration, the majority, he's talking about white people, has become the loser in a racial war. In this context, the book examines the backgrounds, strengths, and weaknesses of the combatants with special emphasis on the assimilable and unassimilable minorities. It records the sorry chronicle of majority reverses on all the important battlegrounds, cultural, religious, political, economic, and diplomatic. Since the liberal minority coalition has emerged victorious on all fronts, it is not an overstatement to describe the losers as the dispossessed majority. The majority's defeat is a great misfire of history, a harbinger of decadence and downfall, for the majority is America. If the former goes, the latter goes, as recent events are making all too clear. The question is no longer the survival of hallowed political, legal, and economic dogmas, but the survival of Western man in the new world, and perhaps in the old. Those who are assuming control of the United States have a long history of failure in the art of civilization. As always, what they cannot measure up to, they are driven to destroy. I think this is a white person. I'm remembering the story. If this was suggested when he didn't have Lothrop Stoddard, but he had this, I suspect he was thinking of somebody writing in the same vein. This is a pretty good find because this seems like a more recent. This was published in 1996. So I was saying I couldn't even think of somebody to make a more current day comparison. Because Lothrop Stoddard, these people were pretty popular. Even that wouldn't be, because I've never even heard of this guy, Wilmot Robertson, but I'll see if maybe we can get him on the program. But I have the book. I'll put it on my Facebook page, The Dispossessed Majority by Wilmot Robertson. Thank you kindly for sharing, full PDF available online. Last 2 points I will make, just paying attention to words since we've been talking a lot about it. Number one, the Long Island Railroad was mentioned. Colin Ferguson, I won't even explain, but just Colin Ferguson. Whenever I hear Long Island Railroad, that's the first thing I think of is Colin Ferguson. Last 2 points, these are just from the Word Guide. There was a segment in the book, Dale Carnegie's book, where he said, I just had it on the page. Here it is. After a few weeks, she said to herself, Maria, you can't expect those women to come to you. You have to go out and meet them. The next time she walked to the water cooler, she put on her brightest smile and said, hi, how are you today? Each of the people she met. The effect was immediate. Smiles and hellos were returned. The hallway seemed brighter. That second brighter, I thought that was significant. That is in the word guide when we use the term bright for to convey that someone is intelligent. And I think in this situation, conveying things were better. I was being treated better. I'd made friends, improved contact with other people around me. Things have gotten brighter. It was dark when it was the other way. I think that suggests a lot about what white people are trying to create with regards to black people and having poor quality relationships. The other wool over the eyes, that is in the word guide, wool over the eyes, because they consistently say that black people have hair like wool and that sort of thing, talking about our hair. And wool over the eyes, another subtle way of signifying that black people really don't know what's going on. They're kind of stupid. These people don't really, they don't really know what's going on. That is in the word guide. Mr. Fuller suggests not using that term. We will be back tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to it. Tune in, review news reports from the past 7 days. If you have workplace triumphs or difficulties, always want to hear those. Looking forward to a constructive, courteous dialogue. Again, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Pacific, Saturday evening. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll have installment number 3 next week. I hope these suggestions can maybe be implemented. If nothing else, remembering to try to minimize the tendency to criticize other victims of racism, including yourself. Not that we can't make improvements. We should strive for improvement. But the just fault finding and getting after other victims, really try and get the clamps on that. Anyone want to do the prayer to wrap things up?
I'll do it.
Right on. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We will be back in about 24 hours. Enjoy the broadcast. Caller, take it away.
Dear Creator and the ancestors, please give us non-white people the strength, clarity, and ability to codify our thoughts, speech, and action, to minimize conflict, to eliminate anti-blackness, and to produce justice. That's it.
Ashe. Context of White Supremacy, signing out. Thank you all for tuning in.
I'm a victim, brother.
A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.